Meeting of Education Innovation Policy will come to order. It is March 20th, the day before spring. We do not have a quorum yet, but members, if this meeting is prolonged, we will reconvene at 7 p.m. in Capitol 120, not till 7 p.m. in 120. So for testifiers in the audience who may not get a chance to testify today, you would need to return at 7 p.m. tonight in Capitol 120, which is in the far eastern side of the first floor, 120. Members, today we are walking through the policy bill, and I'm just waiting for one more member so we can have quorum. So take a time, members, to be looking through the proposal in case when we get to each article, you will ask your questions, I think, after each article, after Ms. Pera has done the walkthrough. So we have Pages joining us. We can take time to introduce them. Pages, just keep standing and say your name and your school. We aren't officially in order yet, but we still love to have you attend. So let's start here at the end. Say your name and your school nice and loud.
I'm Nima Washi. I'm from St. Anthony Village High School. I'm Emma Wagner. I'm also from St. Anthony Village.
I'm Abby Fitzgibbons, and I'm from Bethany Academy.
I'm Christian Elmer, and I'm from Morgan High School.
I'm Six Sabaras, and I'm from Pipestone.
I'm Katie McHenry, and I go for it.
I'm
Alan McCray,
and I go to
Mayberry
High School.
I'm Drew Adamick, and I go to Bethany.
Very good. Thank you for joining us, and please be seated. And what you're going to experience is what's called a walkthrough. In other words, it's a kind of a summary of the policy bill that now has been posted and will be adopted on Thursday as the official 3315 after it has been amended. Members, the meeting can officially come to order now. We have quorum, and the clerk will note the roll. And Representative Jessup, I know you just arrived, but would you quickly look through the minutes to approve the minutes from March 15?
Madam Chair, I move that we approve the minutes.
Representative Jessup moves approval of the minutes from March 15, 2018. Is there any discussion, any corrections? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails, and the minutes are approved for March 18.
Madam Chair, just want one quick note.
Mr. Representative Grossel.
The young lady that announced that she is from Deer River, that's my hometown where I grew up.
Oh, how nice. Will the Deer River young woman stand up? You have claim to fame now because you have a legislator, Representative Matt Grossel, who was born, you said?
Yep.
Born and raised?
In Deer River, yeah.
Born and raised in Deer River. So what a special day for him and for you. Thank you very much. We could probably go down the row now and find out how we're connected to all the others, too. But, Pages, it's great to have you, and very good to have you working on the House floor and in committee for us. So, members, I will put before us the delete all amendment. It is the DE1 to 3315, and ask Ms. Pera to begin the walkthrough. Ms. Pera.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Article 1 is the general education, and it has four sections. Sections 1 and 2 modify the definitions of the textbook and individualized instructional or cooperative learning materials to include a teacher's edition or teacher's guide that accompanies the materials. Section 3, about 10 years ago, the aid to districts, the special education litigation aid, was repealed, so this section just simply strikes that reference from the statute. Section 4 eliminates references to payments procedures. Those are obsolete references. Article 2, education excellence. Section 1 requires the initial serving school district to continue to provide transportation services to and from a cooperative program for a homeless student that has an individualized education program who changes serving school districts during the school year. It allows the initial and current serving school district to mutually agree to an alternative transportation arrangement. Section 2, education records. This section requires a school that is transmitting a transferring student's educational records to a new school to include information about a pupil withdrawal, which is defined later, and to include information about services a pupil needs to prevent inappropriate behavior. Section 3, legitimate exceptions. Allows a student to be excused from school for up to 3 days to participate in any activity necessary to join a branch of the United States Armed Forces. Section 4, required academic standards, has a new paragraph and modifies paragraph D. Paragraph D requires a school district to include child sexual abuse and sexual exploitation prevention instruction in a health curriculum. And it provides some information about what the curriculum has to contain. It allows the school district to consult with other agencies and community-based organizations to identify tools, curricula, and programs. And new paragraph E requires a school district to include instruction in a health curriculum for students in certain grades on substance misuse prevention, including opioids. Next few sections are all amending Section 120B11, which is the world's best workforce statute. And Section 5 adds four definitions, one for state plan, which is a reference to the state ESSA plan that was approved by the United States Department of Education. There are also definitions of an ineffective teacher, an experienced teacher, and out-of-field teacher. Section 6 modifies performance measures. These are used by a school district to create the world's best workforce, and it modifies these performance measures by adding references to the Minnesota Comprehensive Assessments. Section 7, this is the adopting plans and budgets section. A school board has to adopt the world's best workforce plans, and this section adds statewide goals in reference to the benchmarks that are required in the district's plan. Section 8 is report. Districts have to do world's best workforce reports, and the commissioner has to do a report under new paragraph B that includes school performance reports that have student performance using the performance measures that were modified in the previous section. Section 9, World's Best Workforce Annual Evaluation, requires the commissioner to use the performance measures to identify school districts and school sites not making sufficient progress. So it modifies the three-year period. It requires the commissioner to review the curricula of all school districts, well, identify districts the curricula of all identified districts in all subject areas to make sure that the curricula are aligned with state standards. The section also requires identified districts to implement evidence-based strategies and best practices, and modifies the commissioner's report to the legislature by substituting progress toward meeting world's best workforce goals for the district's performance goals. Section 10 requires a school district to screen all students for dyslexia between the beginning of kindergarten and the beginning of second grade, as well as any student who shows characteristics of dyslexia from second grade on. Section 11 modifies Section 120B-122, which was a new section that was added last year, requiring the Department of Education to employ a dyslexia specialist. This section adds a paragraph requiring the dyslexia specialist to provide guidance to school districts and charter schools on accessing screening tools, implementing screening for characteristics of dyslexia, and participating in professional development opportunities on intervention strategies and accommodations for students with dyslexia. Section 12, Secondary Student Personal Learning Plans, amends the Personal Learning Plan statute to require that plans help students access Armed Forces career options, require school districts to grant military recruiters and representatives of careers in the skilled trades the same access to students that they do to colleges and employers, and encourage school districts to sponsor an Armed Forces Career Opportunity Day each fall. Section 13 is a new codifies a new statute on substance misuse prevention, may be cited as Jake's Law, and it encourages school districts to integrate substance misuse prevention instruction into existing programs, curriculum, or school environment. It also cross-references the section a few sections ago that requires districts and charter schools to include this instruction in certain grades in the health curriculum. Section 14, statewide testing, requires the Commissioner of Education to administer to administer the MCAs as late as possible each school year. Currently, students take the MCAs in March, April, or May, and it requires the Commissioner to publish the testing schedule at least 2 years in advance. You'll also see there are three paragraphs that are stricken out. That's obsolete language. It relates to students that entered grades eight or that entered the eighth grade in 2009 or through 2012. So that language is obsolete now. Section 15, statewide and local assessments, clarifies that the MCA student performance data and achievement reports must be available to school districts and teachers within 3 days of the test. That changes on page 22 on lines 10 and 11. Section 16, reporting, requires a school district to disseminate preliminary individual student performance data and achievement reports for the MCAs to a parent and a teacher of a student within 30 days. And it requires the district to notify the parent and teacher that that data is preliminary and still needs to be validated. It also requires a school district to disseminate a testing report to the teacher and parent of each student before the beginning of the following school year, and that testing report has to identify the student's achievement level in each content area and track the student's performance history. Section 17, state growth target. This has several changes. One is that it requires the commissioner to consult with the state demographer to identify student categories used to report student academic achievement and growth. It also eliminates district-wide assessments as indicators of achievement, eliminates the requirement that the commissioner use a value-added growth indicator and to identify schools as medium and high growth, and requires instead the commissioner to report an academic growth rate, which is defined later on, and modifies the graduation reporting requirements by striking out the reference to 4- and 6-year rates. Section 18 is a new section of law, academic achievement rating system. Subdivision 1 requires the commissioner to develop an academic achievement rating system assigned for each school and district. Gives them a star rating and an academic achievement score based on measures set out to determine the rating. And those ratings have to be reported annually on school performance report. Subdivision 2 includes definitions for academic growth rate, low-income student achievement rate, student of color achievement gap score, four-year graduation gap score, low-income student proficient, statewide reading test, statewide math test, and student of color. Subdivisions 3 and 4 are the rating components, and subdivision 3 is for primary schools, subdivision 4 is secondary schools. These were discussed in when the bill was heard earlier. Two components were added to each subdivision. One is the English learner proficiency rate as defined in the approved state ESSA plan, and the other is the consistent attendance rate, also as defined in the approved state ESSA plan. Subdivision 5 is district rating components, which requires the commissioner to base district star ratings on the percentage of third grade students reading rated proficient on the statewide reading test, the low-income student achievement gap score at the district level, the student of color achievement gap score, the percentage of high school students rated proficient on the reading and math test, and the district's four-year graduation rate. Section 19 school performance reports and public reporting requires the commissioner to report the school academic star and academic achievement ratings and to calculate growth rates as required by ESSA. Section 20 is student progress and other data, and that includes data used to set goals for federal expectations in the category of non-public data until the commissioner publicly releases the data. Section 21 Section 21 adds a definition of non-exclusionary disciplinary policies and practices, and this will be coded within the Pupil Fair Dismissal Act. And it defines non-exclusionary disciplinary policies and practices as policies and practices that require school districts to intervene in, redirect, and support a pupil's behavior before dismissing a pupil from school. And it includes several definitions of such practices, including social and emotional services or social work services. And the definition is referenced throughout in some of the following sections. Section 22 adds a definition of pupil withdrawal agreements to the Pupil Fair Dismissal Act. It's defined as a verbal or written agreement between a school or district administrator and a pupil's parent or guardian to withdraw the student from the district to avoid expulsion or exclusion proceedings. Those are limited to 12 months. Section 23 requires a school district, to use non-exclusionary disciplinary policies and practices before dismissal proceedings or pupil withdrawal agreements. Section 24 requires alternative education services when a pupil is suspended for more than 5 consecutive school days. Section 25 minimum education services requires school officials to allow a suspended pupil to complete schoolwork during the suspension and receive full academic credit. It also encourages the principal to designate an employee as a liaison to allow a pupil to receive course materials and complete assignments. Section 26, written notice. This is within the exclusion-expulsion procedures statute, and it substitutes non-exclusionary disciplinary policies and practices where before it referenced alternative education services that had to be given to a pupil to avoid the expulsion proceedings. It also references legal assistance resource list that will be posted on the Department of Education website. Section 27, admission or readmission plan. Requires an admission or readmission plan to include measures to improve pupil behavior and parental involvement, and requires the parental involvement in the process. Section 28, student withdrawals, requires school boards to report student withdrawals through the electronic reporting system to the Department of Education, and include a statement on non-exclusionary disciplinary policies and practices that were given to the pupil. Section 29, policies to be established, requires districts to adopt policies that include non-exclusionary disciplinary policies and practices to ensure that alternative educational services are provided. Requires districts to review a pupil's schoolwork and grades to ensure the pupil is on track for readmission. And provide them a list of mental health and counseling services. Those pupils that receive mental health services through the district in the district remain eligible for those services until they're enrolled in a new district. And it requires, finally, districts to notify parents of how those withdrawal agreements are reported and recorded. Section 30, essential data. This section requires the Professional Educator Licensing and Standards Board, PELSB, to maintain a list of essential data, elements that school districts have to provide about licensed and non-licensed staff members. This is a technical change. This was previously done by the Department of Education Licensing Division, and those functions have moved to PELSB. Section 31 eliminates the requirement that a clerk report to the commissioner the district's revenues as expenditures and some other data that is separately reported to the Department of Education by the school district. Section 32, alternative pupil, allows a non-public 10th grade student to take a career and technical education course offered by Minnesota State College or University through the post-secondary enrollment options programs. 10th grade students in school districts can already do this, can already have this option under the statute. Section 33 eliminates some language that became obsolete in 2013 when the graduation incentives program was modified. Section 34 modifies the submission of American Indian Education Parent Advisory Committee's reasons for not concurring with the educational programs for American Indian students offered by the school board or American Indian School. Section 35, the next few sections are in Chapter 124E, which governs charter schools, so these all apply to charter schools. Section 35 eliminates the requirement that an organization that is applying to be an authorizer have to provide an assurance that it is committed to being an authorizer for the full five-year term. Section 36 accelerates by 1 year the election for an ongoing board of directors and provides that the term of office for that initial ongoing board starts July 1. Section 37, membership criteria, modifies the charter school board of directors membership criteria and requires the board structure to be stated in the school corporation's bylaws. Section 38 modifies the training requirements for charter school board of directors, prohibits an individual from being seated on the board until they've completed certain training. Other training they have 12 months to complete. And there's also some technical changes. Section 39 requires a hearing on non-renewal or termination of a charter school contract to be recorded at the authorizer's expense, and there are preservation requirements for the recording. Section 40, admissions requirements and enrollment. This section makes several changes. One you'll see is that the paragraphs are converted to subdivisions, and so they each have headings now. It adds an agent of a school to the prohibition on charter school distributing services or goods to students and parents, and adds a prohibition on distributing payments or other incentives to students or parents, modifies the conditions in which a student is no longer considered enrolled in the district, and there's two changes to the lottery exceptions that are used when charter schools have to do lotteries. It allows or requires a charter school to give enrollment preference to children currently enrolled in the free preschool or pre-K program. I'm sorry, that was just moved up. That paragraph was moved up. But it requires, provides a preference for students in the city of Nerstrand and Rice County that live within a five-mile radius of a charter school. And it adds a preference for students within 2 miles of a charter school in Castle Rock Township in Dakota County. Section 41 requires the charter school to document its efforts to disseminate required information in its annual report. Section 42, again, that's that that essential data provision. And that eliminates the requirement of the Department of Education maintain that data because PELSB will now maintain it. Section 43 requires basic skills annual expenditure report to be reported under the world's best workforce statute. Section 44 eliminates obsolete reporting requirements for the Minneapolis School District. Section 45, this again is a result of transferring licensing functions from the Department of Education to Pelsby, so it just eliminates a reference to that licensing division. Section 46 includes solicitation of children to engage in sexual conduct and communication of sexually explicit materials in the definition of sexual abuse. Section 47 modifies the paraprofessional pathway to licensure session law and makes charter schools eligible for grants for non-conventional teacher residency pilot programs. It also replaces reference to the Board of Teaching with Pelsby. Section 48 is a revisor's instruction, which recodifies sections of the intermediate school districts in Chapter 123C, which brings it within the K-12 education code. It's currently in the higher ed chapters. And 49 is the repealer, which repeals section on commissioner reporting best practices in schools that are high-performing under federal expectations. It reveals a requirement that districts develop plans and strategies to improve graduation rates for students with emotional or behavioral disorders. Repeals a section that allows districts to request the department to make a payment to a third party. A requirement that school districts report special education litigation costs, and the requirement that the Minneapolis School Board adopt and publish an operating budget and a capital budget for the subsequent year.
Ms. Perra, I'll give you a chance to sip your water to refresh yourself. Members and those in the audience, you need to know how hard how much time and what hard work it takes to put together a proposal like this. Ms. Perra, for example, who's nonpartisan, has worked countless hours and days to produce this product, meeting with us over the weekend. And, of course, my staff, Ms. Peterson and Ms. Windsor and Mr. Withers, we all were here Saturday and Sunday to produce a product like this. So we need to give Ms. Perra just a chance to take a breath because we're now on the lesser pages of the proposal. And with that, I think, Graham, are you the only FFA in the audience visiting, or is it a variety of FFAers? Stand up so that we can recognize you. I saw all of you students walk in, and I did notice Graham on the back of one jacket, but can you call out where you're from? Thank you for visiting. This is Education Innovation Policy, and Graham is close to my district. I have a closest to you would be Mora and Cambridge. So thank you for being here, and we'll resume then with our walkthrough. Article 3, everyone, on page 5555. Ms. Perra.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Article 3 is the teacher article, and Section 1 amends the school counselor statute to require that school counselors present and explain armed forces career options and benefits to students and inform parents and students of the military enlistment exam. It allows counselors to consult with the Department of Labor and Industry on resources for students interested in careers in the skilled trades, and prohibits a counselor from interfering with a student's enlistment in the armed forces. Section 2 authorizes school employees who provide career advice to students to satisfy their professional continuing education requirements by attending training in armed forces career options or careers in the skilled trades. And Section 3 replaces a reference to the Board of Teaching with reference to Pelsby. Article 4, Special Education, establishes a special education working group to review special education delivery and costs. Subdivision 1 goes through the duties, the various issues the group has to examine, including funding and relevant laws. Subdivision 2 lists the members, and paragraph A is a list of organizations, the executive director of which has to appoint or may appoint a representative to serve as a member, and paragraph B requires the Commissioner of Education to solicit applications for membership in the working group, and based on those designate certain individuals to serve as a member of the working group. Since the last time the bill that had this language was heard in this committee, some organizations were added to paragraph A, including the Schools for Equity in Education, Decoding Dyslexia. And in paragraph B, there are now two students receiving special education services and a parent of a student receiving special education services. The rest of that section relates to meetings, compensation, administrative support, and a report. The group has to submit a report with its findings to the legislature by January 15, 2019. And the legislature that convenes next year is encouraged to convene a study group to review those recommendations, to develop its own recommendations for legislative changes. Article 5, Facilities and Technology. This article adopts requirements for technology providers, school districts relating to and charter schools and non-public schools relating to educational data that those technology providers have, and also for student devices.
And Ms. Pear, this places this in the education code. Members, you probably noticed that instead of Chapter 13.
Madam Chair, Ms. Pear. Yes. So Section 1 is actually amends the charter school chapter, simply saying that the charter school has to comply with those sections that are in Chapter 125B, 27 to 25, that govern the technology provider, school issued devices, and educational data. Yes, those other sections are all in Chapter 125B, which generally has technology requirements. Section 2 technology provider requirements, and it imposes new requirements on technology providers and schools that contract with those providers. Technology providers are defined as a person who contracts with a school district to provide technological devices for student use, and who creates, receives, or maintains student data under the contract. These technology providers have to comply with the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act. They do not own the data that they hold under the contract, the educational data. These providers have to comply with the data breach notification law. They have to destroy or return to the school all educational data created, received, or maintained under the contract. And they cannot sell, share, or disseminate educational data except as a part of a valid delegation or assignment of the contract with the school. But they can't use the educational data for any commercial purpose, such as advertising. And Subdivision 3 requires these technology providers to establish written procedures to secure the educational data and allow only authorized individuals to access the data. They also have to maintain a log of use that records information regarding when individuals access student data. Those are generally referred to as audit trails. Section 3 imposes requirements on the school districts. Subdivision 1 requires the district to notify parents and students of the technology provider contracts at the start of the school year, and requires the school district to post the contracts on the district website. Subdivision 2 prohibits a school from penalizing a student who opts out of a technology provider program. Subdivision 3 requires an audit trail, like the one that is required for the technology providers. Subdivision 4 requires the school district to provide training on student privacy laws for new personnel with access to student data, and to provide written training materials for all personnel and independent contractors. Section 4 is school-issued devices, which are defined as any technological device that a school issues to a student for the student's dedicated personal use. It prohibits a government entity, including law enforcement or a technology provider, from using a location tracking device, accessing the device's camera or microphone, or monitoring student interaction with a device. And Subdivision 3 provides exceptions to that prohibition. For example, if it is done for an educational purpose and the student consents, if it's allowed by a judicial warrant, if the device is missing or stolen, if it's necessary to protect the health or safety of a student, or to investigate compliance with the school's acceptable use policy. Subdivision 4 requires a government entity or technology provider that monitors the device for students' health or safety to provide notice of that to the student or parent unless it would pose a threat to health or safety. And Section 5 makes those provisions apply to non-public K-12 schools. Article 6, nutrition. Section 1, food service contracts, clarifies a cross-reference that allows a contract between a school board and a food service management company that complies with federal regulations governing summer food service programs and the child and adult care food program to be renewed for up to 4 years. Section 2, respectful meals policy, clarifies that a school district may collect unpaid meal debt as long as the reminders do not demean or stigmatize a child participating in the school lunch program and meets other requirements. It prohibits the school district from denying a school lunch to participating students, even if the student has an outstanding meal balance, and requires the district to provide meals to participating students in a respectful manner. Prohibits withdrawing the meal after it's been served, whether or not the student has a meal balance. Mm-hmm. Article 7, Early Childhood and Family Support. Sections 1, 2, and 3, all three sections, modify early learning scholarships requirements. Section 1 exempts parents or guardians of children who are in protective services or homeless from requirements to provide income verification to qualify for those scholarships. Section 2 extends the time for a child under the age of 3 who receives a scholarship to complete the developmental screening. And Section 3 strikes the provision that allowed a pilot site to qualify for scholarship before becoming rated through the Quality Rating and Improvement System. And finally, Article 8 clarifies language regarding high school equivalency tests. Last year, the law was amended to allow the commissioner to select more than one high school equivalency test, and each of these sections simply clarifies language relating to that.
Thank you much, very much, Ms. Perrin. Thank you for the work that you have done to accommodate us in preparing this proposal. Now we'll turn to testimony from those in the audience, and we'll lead off with Commissioner Brenda Caselius. Welcome, Commissioner, to the testifying table. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Madam Chair, committee members, Brenda Caselius, Commissioner of Education. Thank you for having me here to testify on the policy bill, and thank you for your hard work this session on the policy bill. Like the chair said, it is difficult work to hear all of the ideas and then put them together into a meaningful way that is easy to understand and that the public feels heard. So I have just a few comments today. I won't speak to all of the comments that I have on the policy bill, but we'll make some kind of broader highlights on the policy bill where we have some agreement, where we maybe can still do some work, and then a couple of items that I think are somewhat problematic. I do want to thank you, Madam Chair, for carrying most of the governor's language on the proposals. I think that these common sense approaches are going to help us move education forward. The biggest policy item I think that we have to deal with, and the students are here today, is around school safety. And so I appreciate you putting in the governor's language around the Pupil Fair Dismissal Act. However, I do believe that we still need some stronger language around threat assessment upon return for students, and that there is a guarantee that students who are posing a risk to themselves or others do get some sort of follow-up and support. So that those two pieces I'd really appreciate if we could work together and in kind of strengthening that language. Also, I'd like to speak to the summative rating system. This is probably the most problematic area given our extensive work with stakeholders and our continued work with stakeholders around reporting and looking at ways to plain language the report, especially to offer reports that are not confusing to parents with two separate different ways to calculate school accountability. We worked over 18 months, 24 months really, with the public, with teachers, with parents, with community and stakeholders, civil rights groups and others around our ESSA plan. And I've heard you compliment it, Madam Chair. And I think that when we do a different rating system than what the stakeholders want and has different measures in it, it becomes highly confusing to parents about which one they should pay attention to. And we've tried a star rating system before, and it was thrown out, and it just didn't work. It's expensive, and I fear that we will have a rating system that won't really give us the information that we actually need to improve schools and improve outcomes for children. And so I would encourage this body to work with us as we work with stakeholders around the issues of reporting to ensure that we can have reports that are meaningful for teachers and also meaningful for our parents in as they choose their schools. The governor feels strongly, of course, about teacher quality. He proposed last year in his letters around eliminating the Tier 2 experience pathway to the Tier 3 professional license. He is advocating again for that change, that we look at the preparation. I also have two other preparation issues that are smaller within the policy bill around our counselors and their preparation in terms of their ability to counsel students, and the ILPs language in the bill, good intending for to have the ILPs strengthened around what counselors are expected to counsel students on in terms of career military pathways. However, we don't have enough counselors in our schools to adequately do this. And so I think that next year, hopefully when it comes back to a funding year, we'll be able to really strengthen our school support systems, our counselors, which will then create more welcoming and safe environments for our schools as well. So I wanted to put that on the bucket list of things to discuss. Also, I'd like to talk about lead in the school drinking water. We made some good movement last year requiring testing and a testing cycle. However, there was no notification to parents if lead is found. And I think parents have a right to know if children have lead in their water. So I'm encouraging the committee here to look at transparency in reporting so that school districts would have to actively notify parents, not just have it on a website what the results were. And I'm not really arguing about how much lead is in the water. Whatever the Department of Health says is a safe amount, then that would be the amount that would be acceptable. So I think that we should come to agreement on what the amount of lead that's safe for children to drink. But then school districts, once they do the testing, should have to either remediate and turn that faucet off or fix it. And right now, all they have to do is test. It makes no sense to test for the water and not notify parents or not fix it. We don't want our children drinking lead in their school water. Also, good movement on lunch debt and shaming. I really commend you, Madam Chair, and committee members for taking on this really shameful act of turning away and throwing away students' food. I think people know how much and how passionate I am about this issue. Want to encourage you to take it just a step further with fees. Some of our schools are not only doing these shameful practices around throwing food out, but they're also restricting kids from athletics, school dances, student council, other activities as well because of school lunch debt. And I just don't think that's right. We know that students' connectedness to school is one of the number one predictors for them to feel welcome, and to do well academically within a school. So why would we shame them further by not allowing them to go to the school dance if they have a school lunch debt? So I certainly hope that the school, you will consider looking at student fees and the lack of opportunities it presents to our poor children. Finally, I'd like, well, there's a couple more things. I'd like to also talk about the World's Best Workforce Alignment and ESSA. I think we make a good step there. I think it's really important, and Madam Chair, you know I've talked about the alignment to standards and assessments and the gaps between what's taught and what's tested, and I think this is a really good attempt to get at the curriculum review. However, the agency just is not set up to review 325 school districts and 140 charter schools, and even if we do a needs assessment and do it within the World's Best Workforce for the 20 districts that we might call in, or 40 or whatever the number might be, curriculum reviews are pretty intensive, and we would need additional resources in order to do a really good job that I think you'd like for us to do, Madam Chair. It's not that I'm arguing we shouldn't do it. I'm not certain we have the expertise in terms of our capacity. We certainly have one or two individuals or three or four individuals, but that would be quite the undertaking. The testing changes that are in there for our testing division to do a two-year testing calendar may interfere with some of our RFP processes when we're in a standards revision year. So I'd just like to put that on the table, that when we're in a standards revision year, sometimes we would then need to go out for a new vendor. So we need to look at that. I appreciate closing the loophole for us to investigate maltreatment to students. Really important for that. I think it's really important that our state growth measures are aligned to ESSA very explicitly, because that specifically is what teachers use in order to gauge students' year-to-year growth. And so they need to know how their students are growing and doing so that they can better improve. And so not having those growth measures aligned, I think, could be problematic. And those, Madam Chair, are my really major concerns and opportunities for us to continue to talk about the bill.
Thank you very much, Commissioner, and be assured we will continue to work on these. The lead in the water, there's not been an agreement reached yet, so even to put a placeholder in the policy bill was not going to work at this time. But otherwise, we'll continue to work with you and staff on trying to reconcile our differences. So thank you very much for coming today and sharing those pros and cons about the policy bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Now, members and audience, we'll start with five-minute presentations by those who wish to testify. And Ms. Liffey will be holding up the sign when your time is coming close. So we'll begin with a teacher from Minneapolis Public Schools, Abby Finger, and Maria Cisneros from the Latino Youth Development Collaborative. And if Ms. Blas and Ms. Ramos will be ready as well. Member testifiers, very, very limited response to the policy. And we may need to add some chairs. Ms. Finger, please say your name for the record and begin.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Abby Finger. I'm a nationally board certified teacher, and I teach GEMS and GUIDES at Green Central in Minneapolis Public Schools.
And welcome.
Thank you. I'm here today because I know that the current discipline practices in schools could serve students better. I know that some of these practices are harmful to my students and other students in our state. I support the discipline language, starting at line 31.25, because it empowers parents and students, as well as improves data collection. We must do better in working with students to keep them in our schools through supporting students and restoring relationships instead of pushing them out of our schools, particularly for minor subjective offenses. These provisions are a step in the right direction towards supporting our students. The discipline provisions strengthen important parent notification rights, student rights, and includes steps that improve communication between the school, parent, and student. I'm going to share an example that highlights the reasons these provisions are necessary for our students, schools, and communities. We can build sanctuary schools that are thriving thanks to the adults that love and care about each other and their students. I have seen the power of restorative practices work with my student, JB, who learned how to communicate his feelings instead of moving to extreme behaviors. And I've seen positive outcomes for students and staff in schools across the district that are implementing restorative practices. Keeping students in schools, non-exclusionary discipline practices help to hold students accountable for their actions and repair relationships to ensure students learn the impact of their actions so as to not make that same decision again moving forward. These provisions are critical to creating a safe school for students, teachers, and communities. Simply put, if students are in class, they are learning. And if they are out of class, they are not learning. And too often, there is an over-reliance on suspension for less serious, subjective infractions, such as disruption. Suspensions are not an effective deterrent and often make students feel less engaged because we are sending a message that school is not for them. Students do not learn the impact of their behaviors with suspensions and are more likely to repeat them. There are alternatives to suspensions that are effective, such as trauma-informed techniques and restorative practices that more effectively get at the root of the issue. And it can be challenging to utilize non-exclusionary practices as a single classroom teacher. These provisions are a step in the right direction and yet could go so much further in terms of training and support. We need the resources to ensure students have the necessary training and support to utilize non-exclusionary practices on a regular basis. And we need the time for teachers with expertise in utilizing restorative practices to share their craft and skills. I hope that you will ensure the use of non-exclusionary practices by providing funding to help share best practices, meaningful trainings on restorative practices, and trauma techniques to ensure all educators and administrators have the tools to educate students in a safe and supportive community. In summary, the discipline provisions are a positive step in the right direction, and I believe it must go further. Reframing how we think of school discipline is too important to become a buzzword. And my fear is that if some provisions are encouraged and not required, they will join other well-meaning education narratives that didn't fully succeed because they weren't carried through by everyone. And at the end of the day, I believe a majority of educators I know want to be student-centered. And if we support them with the resources, techniques, trainings, and sustainable systems, it will ensure that this desire becomes a reality for our students. This is why I believe these provisions are a necessary step to a more student-centered reality. Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee for allowing me to testify and for including these important provisions.
And thank you, Ms. Finger. And the resources needed will be debated in the Finance Committee. But thank you for bringing that up very much. Ms. Cisneros.
Buenos días, Madam Chair y miembros de la Casa.
Please say your name for the record and begin.
Mi nombre es María Cisneros.
My name is María Cisneros.
Nuevamente vengo a abogar por el rating de las escuelas.
Again, I'm coming to advocate for the rating of the schools.
Estoy representando al YDC Desarrollo para la Juventud Latina.
I'm representing LYDC, Latin Youth Development Collaborative.
A mi comunidad y familia latinas y de color.
And the community of Latin families and those of color.
Entendemos que ha hecho varios cambios positivos a la propuesta de ley.
We understand that you've made several changes, positive changes to the proposal of law.
Incluyendo la información sobre los estudiantes de ELL.
Including information about students of ELL.
Esto nos parece muy bien.
This seems very good to us.
Tenemos la confianza de que los resultados académicos
We have the trust that the academic results
de nuestros estudiantes latinos y de color
of our Latin students and those of color
mejorarán con la información que el rating de las escuelas nos puede ofrecer.
Will improve with information that the rating of the schools will provide us.
Ya que simple hecho de poder acceder y comprender
just because of the fact that we can access and understand
cómo está calificada una escuela nos da la oportunidad de aprendizaje.
How a school has been rated gives us opportunity of learning.
Y el desarrollo único de la vida.
And the unique development of life.
Quiero que piensen y que sean conscientes de lo que hacen y lo que pueden hacer.
I would like you to think and to be conscious about what you're doing and what you can do.
No solo será de beneficio para las familias.
It will not only benefit the families.
Sino también aumentará el nivel académico en cada escuela.
But will also increase the academic level of every school.
Otra de las cosas debemos conocer.
Another thing we must know.
Sobre las estadísticas en base de la asistencia.
Is the statistics with respect to assistance.
Pues muchas de las veces nos informan que nuestros niños tienen bajo rendimiento.
Assistance is in present, sorry, because sometimes they tell us that our kids have very low
escolar.
School performance.
Debido a que no asisten a la escuela.
Because they're not going to school.
Nosotros hemos detectado
We have detected
que esto de la mayoría de los casos no es de todo cierto.
We've actually determined that this in majority of cases is not true.
Nuestra comunidad se esfuerza día a día.
Puts a lot of effort day after day.
Para entender el sistema escolar.
To be able to understand the school system.
Pero para esto sigo siendo posible, es necesario.
But for this to continue, it's necessary.
No limitar el derecho de elegir.
Not limit the choice of the right to choose
una mejor escuela.
A better school.
Y el derecho a conocer sobre las diferentes opciones a las que estas ofrecen.
And the right to know the different options that they offer.
Y su decisión y apoyo contribuirá a que nuestros niños tengan más oportunidades en el futuro.
Your decision and support will contribute that our kids have a better opportunities in the future.
De ustedes y de todos nosotros depende la vida académica de nuestros niños latinos y de color.
From you and all of us depends the academic life of our Hispanic and other children of color.
Muchísimas gracias.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mrs. Narros. That was very well said. Then we have Ms. Laz and Ms. Ramos. And thank you, testifiers, for adhering to the five-minute level. Ms. Cisneros finished early. Gives you more time. Welcome. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Mi nombre es Isabel Ramos.
My name is Isabel Ramos.
Tengo tres hijas en las escuelas de Minneapolis.
I have three girls in the schools of Minneapolis.
Estamos agradecidos porque nos han escuchado.
We're grateful that you guys have listened to us.
Sobre la necesidad que tenemos en las comunidades.
About the necessities and needs that we have in our communities.
De conocer los ratings de las escuelas.
Of knowing the ratings of the schools.
A mí personalmente me ha tocado abogar.
Personally, I've had to advocate.
De muchas formas.
From a lot of different ways.
Exigir y ponerme un poco brava.
I've had to demand and actually be a little pushy.
Hasta llevar ayudantes para que me escuchen.
Even bring with me helpers so they will listen.
En las escuelas.
At the schools.
He visto cómo han dado prioridad de elegir escuelas.
I've seen how they give priority to those that choose schools.
A otras personas.
To other people.
Cuando yo pedí una mejor escuela para mi hija.
When I asked for a better school for my daughter.
Quien ha demostrado estar lista para una escuela que ofrece un nivel más alto.
My daughter who has demonstrated that she's ready or was prepared to go to a higher level school.
La respuesta fue negativa.
The response was negative.
Y me dijeron que no me correspondía.
And they said it didn't correspond to me.
Y que era una escuela muy rigurosa y difícil para mi hija.
And that school was very rigorous and difficult for my daughter.
Tuve que hacer muchas llamadas.
I had to make a lot of phone calls.
Enviar cartas y faltar a mi trabajo.
Send letters and miss work.
Hasta que aceptaran a mi hija en la escuela que habíamos elegido.
Until they accepted my daughter to the school we'd chosen.
Las familias no tienen el tiempo.
The families don't have the time.
ni la información necesaria para hacer las mejores decisiones.
Nor do they have the necessary information to make the best decisions for our kids.
No es justo que las escuelas solo tengan altas expectativas.
It's not just or fair that the schools have only high expectations.
Para los estudiantes de las familias que conocen bien el sistema.
To the families of the students or the students of the families that know the system well.
Las que saben bien el idioma.
Or those that know the language well.
Y a las escuelas tienen miedo de hacer enojar.
And those that the schools are scared to make upset.
Se habla tanto de equidad y justicia racial.
We talk so much about equity and social justice.
Pero la verdad.
But in truth.
Las reglas y oportunidades.
The rules and opportunities.
Dependen de las expectativas y el respeto que las escuelas.
They depend on the expectations and respect that the schools.
Tienen para solo un grupo de estudiantes.
Have for only one group of students.
Que ya tienen bastantes privilegios.
Students that already have many privileges.
Sé que ustedes nos están apoyando.
I know that you guys are supporting us.
Para que el rating de las escuelas sea una realidad.
For the ratings of school to be a reality.
Sé que entienden la necesidad.
I know that you understand the necessity.
Y el derecho que existe a tener una buena información.
And the right that exists to have a good information.
Les agradezco en nombre de todas las familias que no están presentes.
I would like to thank you in the name of all the families that are not present.
Thank you, Mrs. Ramos. And, you know, we're so happy and pleased that we have parents who are so concerned about their children's education and being able to place their students in a school that works for you. So thank you so much for coming and sharing your testimony. That's really important to us. Ms. Blas, please say your name for the record and begin.
Buenos días, Madam Chair.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Mi nombre es Fermina Blas.
My name is Fermina Blas.
Estoy aquí preocupada.
I'm here worried.
Por la situación que las familias estamos pasando.
About the situation the families are going through.
Y es que no es una situación fácil.
It's not an easy situation.
No puedo entender cuál es la excusa.
I cannot understand what the excuse is.
O el problema en que las familias conozcamos el rating de las escuelas.
Or the problem that we have for the families to know the rating of the schools.
Es una tontería que en todos los lugares.
It does not make sense in every single place.
Tenemos el derecho a la información.
We actually have the right to information.
Por ejemplo, si vamos a la tienda.
For example, if we go to a store.
Queremos comprar unas galletas.
And we want to buy some cookies.
Tenemos opciones.
We have options.
Hay galletas dulces.
There are sweet cookies.
Galletas saladas.
Salty cookies.
Galletas de coco.
Coconut cookies.
Galletas de chocolate.
Chocolate cookies.
Galletas de todos sabores y colores.
There are different flavors and different colors.
A las personas en esa situación.
And people in this situation.
Contamos con el acceso a la información de los productos.
Count with access to the products.
Entonces uno puede escoger.
So one then can choose.
Lo que quiere o lo que más le conviene.
What they want or what is most convenient for them.
Entonces también en ese momento.
So at that moment.
Incluso podemos ver hasta los ingredientes.
We can even see the ingredients.
Y es más.
Even more.
Si alguien es alérgico a la nuez.
If someone's allergic to nuts.
Por ejemplo.
For example.
Simplemente no compras el producto.
Simply, you don't buy that product.
Y listo.
And then, done.
Y ahora has podido acceder a un producto.
And now you've been able to have access to a product.
Acorde a tu gusto y a tus necesidades.
That fit your needs and your tastes.
Pero resulta que cuando una familia quiere elegir una escuela.
But it turns out when you want to choose a school, the family wants to choose a school.
La información no está a la vista.
The information is not visible.
No sabemos casi nunca.
We almost never know.
Las calificaciones de la escuela.
The rating of the schools.
El progreso que han tenido en las clases.
The progress that they've had in the class.
Y mucho menos.
And a lot less.
Cómo están las calificaciones de las otras escuelas de la zona.
And how the ratings are of the schools of other zones or areas.
Y cuando uno pide información.
And when we ask for this information.
Casi siempre nos dicen.
Almost always they tell us.
Que debemos hacer una cita.
That we need to make an appointment.
Y terminamos hablando con alguien.
And we end up talking to someone.
Que nos habla.
That talks to us.
Y nos muestra una información enredosa y poco entendible.
That shows us information in a very confusing and not very understandable way.
Y terminamos sin saber.
And we end up without knowing.
¿Qué nos ofrecen las escuelas?
What the school is actually offering.
O si son aptas para nuestros hijos.
Or if they're apt for our children.
Es urgente que tengamos el acceso claro a la información.
It's urgent that we have direct access, clear access to this information.
De las escuelas.
Of the schools.
Muchas de las familias que estamos pidiendo el acceso a esta información.
Many of the families are asking for access to this information.
Somos familias.
Our families.
Que no estamos familiarizados con el sistema.
They're not familiarized with the system.
Pero que estamos dispuestos a dar el apoyo a nuestros hijos.
But that we're there and interested in giving support to our children.
Y haremos todo lo posible.
And we will do everything that's possible.
Por ver a nuestros niños.
To see our children.
Graduarse de la high school.
Graduate from high school.
Y que tengan éxito en la universidad.
And be successful at the university level.
Pero necesitamos que nos den las herramientas.
But for this we require the tools.
Para que la elección de las escuelas
for the choice of the schools
sea la más fácil
to be the easiest
y la más conveniente para cada familia.
The most convenient for each family.
Gracias por su atención.
Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Ms. Glass, and thank you again to you moms who've come today to stand up for your children and for the best school possible for them so they can succeed. Thank you very much. Members, it's always delightful to have parents testify. Next, we have Jeff Snyder from the Hayfield Education Association and Bailey Bolter from Solutions Not Suspensions. If you two would join us at the testifying table to provide your testimony. Is Ms. Bolter? Yes, here she comes. Welcome, Mr. Snyder. Please say your name for the record and begin.
My name is Jeff Snyder. Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. I am a high school math teacher at Hayfield High School. It's in southeast Minnesota. Thanks for allowing me to speak with you today regarding Section HF 3315 and the star ratings for the schools. It's a very important issue, provision for me, I should say. As I am in a rural school district, a smaller school district, that has a low SES as a district of 30%. That's the low-income families of 30%, and that just in the district. And knowing that multiple families don't take it, our rate has exceeded 40% several times in the past decade. With that, so one of my big concerns with this section is the fact that decisions regarding the ratings of each student can have a dramatic impact on public perception and pride amongst the students, the school, and the community. There are a lot of great schools in Minnesota with staffs that work very hard to make sure that every student does have success. But not all school districts and not all situations are created equal. Every student in every district has their own story and their own level of success. Putting our students next to another district and comparing them apple to apple can put an unfair label and stigma on our students, our community, and our school district. Is that really what we want to do? Label our youth before they even have a chance to go out and into the real world and make names for themselves? I have several students that have to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning just to get their chores done on their farms or around to help take care of their brothers and sisters as well before they even come to school. Should we compare those students to other students who have families with the financial means that allow them to solely focus on their education? I have concerns with that. Lastly, in education, we want to dream about making any decision on one data point, one test, or one single item of data. Why would the state consider basing a rating off of one data point? I teach statistics, and my students would laugh at me if I showed them a study that based things off of a single data point, especially an MCA test that isn't given to each student in each grade in all subject areas annually. Okay, so I know that there's a lot of tough decisions and a lot of things that have to be made with regards to this, but please be mindful, as you are considering this provision, and remember that tying these star ratings to such a small sample set does not necessarily validate the data. Thank you for your time, and your focus on education of each individual student.
Thank you, Mr. Snyder, and thank you for teaching, especially for teaching math. We're very proud of our math standards. I should say I'm very proud of our math standards. So I know you have a real challenge. As you know, those were mostly created by University of Minnesota. Yes. So Minnesota has very robust math standards, which I know you have learned.
Well, they do, and we work very hard to achieve those.
I'm sure you
do. Good things.
How do your students respond to them?
Students have responded pretty well. Our scores have significantly increased in the last few years, and we just continue to focus on those and keep working on accomplishing higher achievement. So.
Yes, and thank you. And as I've spoken to math teachers at the high school level like you teach, they're intrigued by ways and strategies to use to teach those standards. And I've heard nothing but good things about what they're doing to the students because it's kind of exciting them. And that's great in math. We want that.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Snyder, and thank you for taking time to be with us. Ms. Bolter from Solutions Not Suspensions, welcome. Say your name and begin.
Hi, thank you. Chair Erickson and members of the committee, my name is Bailey Belter, and I'm on staff with the local Solutions Not Suspensions Coalition. Solutions Not Suspensions, or SNS for short, is a statewide coalition of students, families, community members, and organizations committing to changing policies, practices, and mindsets in order to end racial disparities in discipline and foster a positive school climate for all students. We like that House File 3315 includes requiring schools to use non-exclusionary discipline policies before dismissing students. Our coalition believes strongly in using restorative practices, which can not only repair harm on relationships, but also keep students in school and the climate dignifying. We know the state of Minnesota has some of the most glaring racial disparities around education, and that using a way of being, like restorative practices, can only help. This is a small step forward to ensuring students are engaged in learning and educators and families are given the tools they need to succeed. We would also love to include the provision on providing parent notification, the parent notification requirement for dismissals, arrests, seclusions, as well as allowing students not to self-incriminate. This version is being considered in the Senate Education Bill right now. In conversations with many parents from all around the state and hearing from Senator Pratt, it is imperative for schools and families to be on the same page when it comes to communication of their child's well-being and education. We ask for this provision to be included in the House version of the bill as well. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Bolter. Now we'll have a Mark Deal from Little Falls. He's a technology coordinator. And Jessica Webster from Legal Aid. You would both come forward. Welcome, Mr. Deal.
Thank you.
Please say your name for the record and begin. And please reference the section of the bill if you have specific remarks
sure.
to make.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mark Deal. I am the Director of Information and Technology Services for Little Falls Schools. And I'm here this morning to talk specifically about some parts of Article 5 dealing with the facilities and technology. There it's no doubt that as technology professionals and as educators, we take data privacy seriously. And I think we have a common agreement that is an important task for us to accomplish. However, I do have some concerns about portions of this bill, specifically around auditing, the opt-out provision, and the training. Let me talk about the auditing for a second. It's not hard for us to generate logs of data that address what changes have been made. The challenge that comes before us and what's asked of us in this bill is how do we address if data is looked at? You can have multiple points of data on a screen. Let's just take, for example, a teacher in the, going into their grade book to look and access students' information from a parent request about an assignment. Well, in that electronic gradebook, a teacher has 25 students, let's say, for example. How are we to audit that, what data was looked at? Are we going to have to report that every, are we going to have an audit that says, well, this student's data was looked at, even though child A was the child that we were looking for, the teacher was looking for information on, yet child C's classroom, class assignment grade is also listed there as well, but wasn't the focus of the data. And it becomes a really tricky problem for us to try to address which data points that are on a specific screen are really being looked at. And so we really would like to challenge you to, I would like to challenge you to consider removing anything that deals with reading of the data. I'm not sure how we could feasibly even make that happen. I'm not sure that our vendors that we contract with for these systems could provide that as well. Let me talk about the opt-out for a second. Opt-ins, opt-outs become really challenging. The way that the bill is currently written, it does not address whether or not this is specific to instructional-only resources, or does this also include administrative-type resources. So let's take, for example, a student information system. If a parent has the right to opt out of a student information system, what are the unintended consequences of that? Well, I'm not sure that Commissioner Casilius would appreciate getting a stack of papers from a district for MARS information on students because we can't report them automatically from within a student information system. Those are challenges. How do we schedule busing? How do we schedule food service? How do we have students make food service payments? How do we report that that time back out? And lastly, there's the I just want you to understand that the training aspect of this portion really is going to require us to have a cost. It's a cost of, there's a financial cost, but there's also the cost of time. And what do we put our priorities to as a district in terms of all of the other initiatives that we have going on? So with that, Madam Chair, I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Deal. Those are very important points of interest for you to express to us, because we are, you know, looking at this very carefully. The opt-out request, as I'm reading it on in subdivision 2 under section 3, lines 6126 and 6127, is permissive. Do you think most districts would choose to have an opt-out for in their contract, Mr. Deal?
I don't think districts would want to choose to have an opt-out. I think that becomes problematic for us to track, whether it's on an administrative type system or an instructional system. It creates another level of challenge for the teacher if it's on the instructional side in terms of trying to provide other resources. It creates a whole level of time expectations on the administrative side for how do we deal with all these paper copies. So I don't think we would want to have opt-out in there at all.
Thank you, Mr. Deal. And under training, line 62.18 and what follows, are the staff of Little Falls District educated on what FERPA is, Mr. Deal?
Are we educating them? Yes, we educate our staff on what FERPA is.
So that training is taking place?
It does happen, yes. Now, I noticed that in the bill it requires that to happen within 30 days of hire.
Yes.
That becomes a bit of a challenge. We've recently in our district hired for next school year a teacher who is coming to us from the Des Moines area. Well, she's signed her contract. At what point is the date of hire? Is it the date that she signed her contract? That's going to be really challenging for us. Are we to send somebody to Des Moines to offer her this training within 30 days? So we do the training, but There are some provisions in here that would make things challenging, but it does take time. It takes time to pull that off, and it takes away from other things.
And, Mr. Deal, one final question on Subdivision 3 under procedures, you know, which you call the audit trail.
Yep.
So, you know, I used to keep my grade system, of course, in our software program. So now this is suggesting that if I'm in the grade program for my English students, that I'm going to have to indicate when I try to access each student's grade reporting. Would it be that extensive, or is it broader than that, Mr. Deal?
The way I interpret the language is that it has to be reported to a parent. If a parent requests, it has to be reported that that educational record was viewed. So if you have 25 kids in your class, and if in our student information system grading scheme, all those students are listed there in the class, am I looking at student A, B, and C? Or if I'm only looking for information about student A, do I still have to report about the other 24 students? The way I interpret this language is that we would have to report on all 24 of those other students.
Thank you very much, Mr. Deal. Very insightful comments on this proposal. Welcome to the, and thank you, Mr. Deal, for making the trip from Little Falls. I know that takes a little bit of time. Thank you, Ms. Webster, for joining us again today. Please say your name and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Jessica Webster. I'm a staff attorney with Legal Aid, and I just wanted to provide some brief comments on Article 6, the nutrition article. I wanted to thank the chair and members for tackling this lunch shaming issue. I know it's not easy. I know our districts are experiencing unpaid meal debt, and I know that our districts are using some lunch shaming policies and practices that they don't want necessarily to be using but feel they need to use. So I appreciate you tackling this issue. This language, it's not as far as I wanted it to go. That's usually the case. But I think I appreciate Commissioner Casillas's strong voice on this too. And she mentioned going further with student fees, school dances, student councils, activities. That's not something that I have advocated this session. I appreciate her concern on that issue. I have some much more basic protections that I would appreciate this committee still considering. And it's just two. And it's one, ensuring that children can participate in graduation ceremonies. I sent two written policies to the department on Friday from Floodwood and Kelleher that don't allow children with meal debts to participate in graduation events. So that would be one ask. And I'm not talking about parties. I'm talking about graduation and rehearsal for graduation. The second would be not allowing districts to or schools to punish a child who has a meal that is attempting to purchase food. So that is a policy we saw at Battle Lake, where a child with a meal debt was, it's a policy that allows a school to issue detention or suspension for a child that attempts to purchase food. So those are, if there could be one more sentence, two very basic protections for graduation and a limit on punishment, I would really appreciate consideration of those two. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Webster. And I know Representative Juergens is still working on language, but we wanted to put this in so we had a starting point for the school lunch part. So thank you very much. And thank you both of you again. Sue Abderholden, will you come forward, please? And Josh Crossan. Welcome to the committee, and please say your name for the record and begin. And Ms. Abderholden, we'll begin with you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota, and thank you for the opportunity to testify. I just had a couple of comments. On page 7 and 15, where you talk about substance use disorder education, mm-hmm. I'm wanting to make sure that the kind of education efforts and curriculum actually are somewhat research-based. Because there are a lot of people that go out there and kind of talk about it, and you want to make sure that there's, you know, some research behind it. On page 31, line 0.29, You have in there social and emotional services, but I think you actually want that to mean social and emotional learning. And social emotional learning curriculum that's actually, again, more research-based. And in that same...
Ms. Abderholden, yes, would you hold on a second? Because yep. Ms. Pera wants to reference this since she helps us make these changes. So on line 31.29, you're saying it should be social and emotional learning services?
Learning.
Just learning.
Or learning curriculum, yes.
Thank you.
And then on line 35.14, there's a couple of times in this kind of section where you talk about school-linked, which is actually the correct statutory reference, but then in another place you call it school-based, and just wanting to make sure that you're referencing the grant program, so it's school-linked.
Thank you very much.
Also on 35.17, it talks about the school district providing to the pupil's parent or guardian a list of mental health services available after expulsion, and it has to be posted on the district's website. I just want to say this is a really difficult thing for anyone to do. What a family needs to do is first find out who is in their insurance network, which can also be very limited. You don't want to refer someone to a provider who's not in their network, and then they're going to have to pay 100% out of pocket or a much higher percentage out of pocket. So I think it might be easier, rather than listing that services, you could list the community mental health provider in the community that has to do sliding fee, or you could hook them up, for example, with the school social worker or the school-linked mental health provider to find someone who can be in their network. But just listing that and keeping it up to date, I think, would be kind of a logistical nightmare. Appreciate the thought on that, but I think it would be very difficult for school districts to do.
I think that's an excellent suggestion. Thank you.
And then moving on to 57.4, which is the special education work group, there is the sentence about comparing relevant state and federal special education laws and regulations, which, you know, as you know, we've had numerous reports on that. So perhaps just including the reports on that so that you're not doing that whole activity all over again. And then I would also just recommend on 57.8, the clause 4, it says identify strategies or programs that would be effective in reducing the need for special ed services. And I would suggest actually also adding more intensive special education services, because sometimes a student may continue to need special ed, but perhaps you can work on having it not be quite as intensive, which would also bring down the costs, which I thought might also be helpful. I see that you're repealing 120B.35 subdivision 5, which was language that I had worked on way too many years ago. And just wanted to point out that we still have a lot of students in the EBD category who actually don't graduate. And I realize this was never really implemented, and so I understand why you would eliminate it. But just as a reminder that those are the students that we have a very high dropout rate. And then lastly, because there's been a lot of talk about the need to really look into threat assessments and things like that, there's been kind of two languages, phrases that have been used. One is threat to others, and one is threat to self. And I really want to urge you to separate those two things. Threat to self is really about suicidal behavior, students who may be injuring themselves or others. That's a totally different ball of wax. You need to actually make sure that those students are getting referred to the help that they need. It's not a disciplinary issue. It's nothing like that. It's students who are not misbehaving. It's students who have lost hope. And so we just would really like to make sure that we don't lump them in with students who may be a threat to others. Thank you for the opportunity.
Well, thank you very much. Those were very much needed comments for clarification, because we miss things and we don't always know about repealers to the extent that some of our testifiers do. So we appreciate that very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Crossan, welcome. Say your name for the record and begin.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Josh Crossan with Ed Allies. Ed Allies is an education advocacy nonprofit that works to improve our public education system for each and every kid in the state of Minnesota. Madam Chair, I'd like to thank you for presenting what we think is a good bill. Going down the list of the sections that are on our radar, Section 14 around assessments, distribution of assessments, and reporting that data. We appreciate the provisions that require the Commissioner publish the test schedule for at least 2 years advance notice. I think the commissioner brought up an interesting point, an important point. In other pieces of law, there are just small provisions that say unless standards change in state and federal law. I think that's an easy addition to add, and I think that would be very welcome. Individual student performance data must be given to parents and teachers 30 days after the test has been administered, with a preliminary disclaimer. I think this is also a very important provision to include. During testimony on this legislation, we found out that 1/100th of 1% of tests need to be modified or altered for validation studies. So I think this gets to the heart of what this legislation is about. We also like the idea of longitudinal data, making sure that students understand how they're growing and learning throughout the years that they're in school. One thing that I would add is clearly defining what as late as possible means. I think we're almost there in terms of negotiating with the department and other school districts, but the OLA recommends a 25-day window. I think we can get there. So thank you. Second issue is really around the accountability, Section 18. I will just say from my personal experience in education, I was destined to go to a high school that had a 17% high school graduation rate, 7.17. My parents weren't as intelligent or articulate or aware of their education system as the parents who testified in support of this legislation. My family saw my mom choosing a different option for me as a waste of time, a waste of money, because all schools are created equal. And I think that this section is desperately needed for parents of color, immigrants, and parents who just don't have the wherewithal to understand our education system as thoroughly as we do here today. So this provision requires indicators of proficiency, growth, low-income gap closure, students of color closure, English learner proficiency, and attendance to be all indicators in how we rate and understand how our schools are doing. I think this aligns better to the previous provision, previous law. It aligns better to our ESSA indicators that we created as a state. It also adds gap closure to those indicators, which I think is important. So I appreciate the chair's amendments and responding to the most critical pieces of feedback from those earlier testimonies. And also includes high school graduation rates. I forgot to mention that as well, that indicator. So there are an array of indicators as part of that accountability system, so we appreciate that. And then lastly, as a member of the Solutions Not Suspensions Coalition, I would love to echo Ms. Belter's testimony and say that we fully support and thank the Madam Chair for including the Department of Education's provisions on using non-exclusionary disciplinary policies. Looking at before, during, and after, how can we make sure that students are engaged, that families are engaged, and learning in school? One thing that I would just add, like Ms. Balter said, was the provisions in the Senate. It will likely be in the Senate Education Omnibus Bill, but it was heard in the Senate as well, but a parental notification requirement. This is parental notification for any dismissals, arrests, seclusions, just notifying parents when those occur. And then the other issue that I would love to see in this bill would be a provision just to allow students to not self-incriminate, that they can provide their side of the story, but just a provision in law that gives students due process around suspension specifically. So with that, thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Crossan. Ms. Clark from Coalition for Children with Disabilities. Members, after Ms. Clark, let's take a few minutes to raise some questions, because we will recess and resume tonight at 7 p.m. in Capitol 120. And as you can see, I've left those who are regularly visiting us to the end. Sorry about that, ladies and gentlemen. But Ms. Clark, welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sarah Clark. I'm here today on behalf of the Pacer Center and the Coalition for Children with Disabilities, and thank you for having me testify this morning. I thought I'd be seeing you all this evening, but I'm going to go take a midterm tonight. So I want to express our support for a couple of pieces in this bill. The non-exclusionary disciplinary practices have been noted by other testifiers today, I think, is a step in the right direction for students with disabilities. Students with disabilities are disproportionately impacted by suspensions, expulsions, and seclusion. And like Josh just mentioned, I hope we can see some parental notification language so that our parents can be more involved in supporting their children through restorative disciplinary practices. Finally, I want to thank the chair and this committee for their approach to the special education working group. I think this conversation is very important and much needed, and I appreciate that the House really values the expertise and the insight of folks who are most directly impacted by this, including advocates, students, and other professionals. So thank you for this bill, and we wanted to share support. Thanks again for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Clark. Representative Ward, you had a question, and before there might be someone in the audience, and maybe it was for the commissioner, but Mr. Oney is here if your question was for MDE. The commissioner's still here. My goodness, she gave up her time to be with us. Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, it's an important bill, and I'm very grateful, too, that we have so many helpful people to talk to us. My questions, my goodness, I had a few. Just an overall thing, I think that we've made some really good progress with this bill. I do have some concerns. In general, I notice a lot of change in language from shall to must, so a lot of mandates. And I'm assuming that in the Finance Committee this will be covered because there undoubtedly will be some expenses associated with those. I just wanted to raise that concern. I wanted to comment about the restorative practices being mentioned frequently. That's a huge part of my background, and I have years of work in schools using restorative practices, so I'm just delighted to see it being embedded in the schools. I have a real question about the mental health and counseling, and perhaps Ms. Abderholden, if she's still here, might need to comment. I think you referenced
Ms. Abderholden, if you'll come
being
forward
sure,
again.
Thank you. Being sure that there are references made to or referrals made to in-network. What happens when there's no insurance? What happens to the students then?
Ms. Abderholden, will you reintroduce yourself and then respond?
Yes, Madam Chair, members. Sue Abderholden, NAMI, Minnesota. Madam Chair, Representative, if a family doesn't have insurance, then they would actually, through a school-linked mental health project, that's what some of the grant monies are used for, is for students who are uninsured. But then all of the community mental health centers also have to have a sliding fee. And so, again, if you don't have insurance, then they would look at your income and charge you, you know, accordingly.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Does this also, sometimes students are involved in discipline or challenges in school, not because of their own mental health, mm-hmm. but because of the family's mental health situation. So if a student is called in on a disciplinary issue and it's really involving parents, family members, a sibling, is that something that the school then would make a referral to, especially if they don't have insurance? To a provider?
Madam Chair, Representative Ward, that would certainly be appropriate. I mean, if you look at kind of trauma-informed practices in schools, it's not, you know, what did you do but what happened to you. And so a child especially can, having a parent who has a mental illness or even a sibling who has a serious mental illness or substance use disorder, can actually impact them. And so therapy and supports and coping strategies being taught to them would be extremely helpful. So they could, in fact, be referred to school-linked mental health if there, frankly, are enough openings, which we know that right now there are not, but also to a community mental health center.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a clarification, because you mentioned chemical dependency. So a chemical problem could also be referred, but what happens when there is no insurance and there are no facilities available?
Ms. Abderholden.
Madam Chair, Representative Ward, again, community mental health centers and even just community health centers can provide that kind of support for people who don't have insurance and or have low incomes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Ward. Part of the change from shall to must, I will let Ms. Para address after I mention that we struggled with the change on page 7 in regard to what we passed last year, Aaron's Law, and this year the proposal that came forward from Girls United about whether they should be mays or musts. And then in light of Representative Kunesh Padin's Jake's Law, which was a must, we decided we'll take, the chair decided, we'll try the must and send it on. And, of course, I've already heard about that 2 days in a row. So it may become permissive again. But as I said to school board members yesterday, the three provisions, child sexual abuse, sexual exploitation, and substance abuse, are so essential to a health curriculum that I don't understand why we wouldn't feel very strongly about those being incorporated into the health curriculum. And if there's a cost, and I know that Representative Kunesh Padin in Jake's Law has a provision that's in finance, but we'll be addressing that, and so you'll be included in those discussions. But Ms. Para will respond to the shells to must.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Ward. Shall is generally interpreted as must. But as we're going through the statutes and modifying or amending them for different reasons, we're kind of just going through and cleaning that up and making it must for clarity. It's not intended as a substantive change.
Thank you. And members, we can thank former member Phyllis Kahn, as Representative Mariani remembers, for the shall to must. She was adamant about that several years ago, and we began to make those changes. Representative Mariani.
I'm sure I shudder to recall some of the floor debates on shall and must. As much as I love Representative Kahn, I'm just curious. I know we're about to recess. Can you just lay out for us a little bit about what you expect to committee accomplish? What are we going to be focusing on this evening? I know that amendments are due, and so I want to make sure that staff has the time to be able to work with members who are going to offer amendments.
Yes, Thursday will be our markup day. Okay. And sending the bill out, and the deadline for amendments is 3 o'clock Wednesday. So that will be the expectation for the future. As for today, I'd like to hear from as many of you as possible, as well as those in the audience who will return tonight to give us input.
Thank you, ma'am.
But please, members, do ask questions. Representative May Quaid, you're on the list next.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This question, it could be for you. I wanted to ask the bill author, but I didn't get a chance to, and it has to do with the star rating. So my first question is, I'm on page 28, line 28 point, we'll start with 1.2 through 1.7. So students of color achievement gap score is 100 minus the average of the statewide percentage of white students rated proficient minus the school's percentage of students of color who are rated proficient. And my question is, how does that show a gap in a school? Because if the students of color in that school do better than the statewide average of white students, but they're doing less well than the white students in that school, it wouldn't show a gap. And so I wanted to understand how using that rating would help.
Representative May Quaid, I'm going to ask Jim Bartholomew to come forward because I know that he did work with Representative Peterson on this proposal, and I would ask for his response to this particular paragraph. Welcome, Mr. Bartholomew. Please say your name for the record and begin. And we only have about 2 minutes.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Jim Bartholomew with the Minnesota Business Partnership. Representative May Quaid, I think the state average for white students was used both because it'll be more stable than the school's population of white students. And I think the flip would also apply that you may have a school where the white students at that school are doing less well than the white students statewide. I think the statewide white student performance was a more consistently higher bar, if you will, or expectation.
Representative May Quaid.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So explain to me how that would then show a gap, because if you are seeing that students of color in a school are doing as well as white students statewide, but they're not doing as well as the white students in their school, this rating would not tell parents that. Where there is a gap, it wouldn't show that gap.
Mr. Bartholomew.
Madam Chair, members, Representative McQuaid, you're right in the sense that the mechanics are you would look at the students of color performance at that school compared to the white students statewide. And if that school students of color are doing better, then essentially that school would get a full one, a score of 100, the maximum that they could score. Mm-hmm. And the intent is to show for schools that have gaps, the wider the gap, the lower the score, the less of a gap to no gap, then they would get the full 100.
And Mr. Bartholomew, you'll be with us tonight so we can continue this discussion. So, members, if you would put all of your files back in your folders to help out our pages for tonight, then this meeting stands in recess. And remember, we will reconvene.
Summative ratings, and this is on pages 27 through 30 of the bill. As amended, the summative ratings for schools will have a strong alignment with the state's ESSA plan. They'll have grade level performance, ELL progress, student growth, consistent attendance, and then an added focus on closing student achievement gaps. For districts, the ratings are aligned with the world's best workforce. Providing summative ratings will attract and help families and the public organize and use the information MDE already has on their website. As Ms. Cadera from the Data Quality Campaign mentioned, Minnesota has some of the best information in the country. We just don't do enough to make it accessible. With 44 states committed to providing summative ratings in their ESSA plans, this is also a common sense thing to do. To the degree that we can help families use MDE's website and information rather than what's available on third-party independent rating websites, the better information they'll have, and that's a good thing. Thank you for your time and commitment to our students.
And I know there are questions for you, Representative Makeway.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Bartholomew, just to get back to where we were at the very beginning. So we were talking, we're on page 28. Let's start with 28.12. So the students of color achievement gap score is 100 minus the statewide percentage of average of white students who rated proficient minus the percentage of students of color who are rated proficient in that school. Tell me how telling us what students of color in a school did compared to white students at the statewide average helps parents understand the gap in that school.
Mr. Bartholomew.
Madam Chair, Representative McQuaid, glad you asked and had a chance to go and look at District 196 for an example. And I think the point of trying to, we're a state with some of the worst achievement gaps in the country between students of color and white students, low-income and non-low-income students. So I think it's important to recognize schools that are doing a good job closing and eliminating those gaps. And I think that's one of the strengths of this system is that it's not just a proficiency-based system. It looks at student growth and ELL progress and closing the gaps. And one of the things that would tell you, for example, in 196 that you could look in, you know, say we have this on a state, what you could look at your neighboring districts. But for 196 in math, you have a 14% gap between students of color and what the statewide white performance. In reading, that gap is, again, 14%. Now, what we could do is look at the neighboring districts, if you wanted, to see what the, you know, and that's going to net out to, let's say, an 86 would be your score if it's 14. That would be broken out, and you could see how District 196 is helping students of color close the gap on a
compared to the statewide white students. And you could be higher, lower, right in on par with everybody else, but it gives you a place to start. How are students of color or low-income students in this school or this district doing relative to other schools and students? And if it's a school, if we can look over time, that it's 14 and 27, in 2018 it's 10, and then it moves to 6, there's something going on there. Parents should know about it. Educators should know about it. The state should know. There's something going on that's good, some best practices that we can look at. Conversely, if it's going the other direction, that's a red flag that people should be looking at. I think from a public's perspective and a family's perspective, that type of information would be very helpful.
Madam Chair, President Nate, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think you're conflating what's helpful for families for their own students, and I'm not sure what else. So I'll give you an example. Let's stay with ISD 196. The graduation rate for ISD 196 is 91.93, okay? For all students of color, it's 86%. The statewide average for white students is 88%. So that would say that there's a very small gap, about 2% for all students of color in ISD 196, except white students in ISD 196 graduate at 94.12%, a much wider gap. That is important for parents to know because that's how they know how are students of color doing in this school compared to their white peers, not how are students of color doing in this school compared to the average of white students across the entire state. That is where the real gap is, and that is what this would not show. Additionally, I want to understand how putting all students of color, so you've got American Indian, Asian, Pacific Islander, Hispanic, and Black, and or two or more races, all in one category. So going back to the ISD 196 example, Asian students graduate at 90.97% compared to their white peers at 94 or all at 91. Black students are at 81%, and Native students are at 85%. So how does grouping every single student of color, and so that would be myself, Representative Kunesh Kodine, Representative Fu Lee, Representative Carlos Mariani, we'd all be in one category of students of color, and then comparing that to the entire, I guess, statewide white average, how would that be helpful for my parents or Mary's parents or Fu's parents or Carlos's parents? Because we are all from very different backgrounds and ethnicities, and they're all very different needs. So tell me how that would be helpful for parents who have students of color.
Mr. Bartholomew.
Madam Chair, Representative Makewade, I think that you've got a couple things. One, the rating system is intended to be a starting point for parents to bring them into the state's website so they can get a sense, a quick sense of which schools or districts in this case they'd like to explore more. It's not meant to be an end-all, be-all. This number tells you where you should enroll your students. So I think it's important to keep that in mind, that this is a way to drive, encourage parents to come to MDE's website and use their report card for additional information. I think the bill uses the statewide white students for a couple reasons. One of them is if you use students of color at a school compared to a school's white students, not saying this would happen, but there are incentives, perverse incentives, potentially to game the system. You can reduce your gap by bringing one group of students up or another group of students down. By using a statewide number, that's less likely to happen. It's a statewide number. So it's going to be more consistent. And again, I think, you know, in using your example for ISD 196, if you're getting 90-plus points for the graduation rate gap, that's a good thing. And if parents, so that should be reflected in a rating system, and parents would look at that, and if they want to dig in and unpack the students of color numbers, it's right there on the department's website, and that's what we would hope they'd do.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We don't have to keep going around in the circle. I want to address two things. First, to suggest that teachers would in any way decrease the success of their white students to close the gap, I think, is pretty absurd. And there's no teacher in Minnesota who is doing that. I just want to state that categorically. I think the whole point of this, right, was to have a summative rating that was information for parents to use to help them use the data. It was said over and over again so they can make the right decision. So this is information they can use. And yet you're explaining to me that this is just something that you can start in, and then my parents could, for example, then look at all the other ratings at all the other districts around. But I thought the whole point of the summative rating was so that when they looked at it, they were getting information that they can then use. So I'm pretty much against the summative ratings to begin with because we've been down this path, but none of what this is doing is giving information to parents that is in any way useful for me if I was a parent, for my parents if I was still in school. This is just, I'm not even sure what the whole point of putting this on, because it doesn't actually give information to any parent. It doesn't give information about mixed-race students. It doesn't give information about specific black types of students. It doesn't give information about special education students. It doesn't give any information about students. It gives information about test scores compared to white students around the state. And the last thing I'll say, and then I'll let others ask questions, is out of all of these measures, the summative ratings, I hope you will realize that you have left out white students and how they're doing out of all of it. So, for example, using ISD 196, we'd know how students of color do compared to the statewide white average. We know how low-income students do compared to the statewide non-low-income average. But what if white students in this district aren't doing very well? I mean, that also doesn't tell us any of that information, and I don't know if you know this, but we have a lot of white students in Minnesota. So none of this is helpful information for parents, and I think that this needs a lot of work before it's even palatable and useful, if we're even going to use it.
Madam Chair, Representative Makewait, this, I don't want to get in tit for tat, but this includes all kids when you're looking at grade level performance. It includes all kids when you're looking at student growth. It includes all kids when you're looking at attendance. So to suggest that we're not looking at all kids, we're only focused on certain groups of kids, we can visit later. I think this provides a lot of good. I don't think anyone has ever said that this, you should look at the number of stars a school has and decide that's where you're going to send your kid. I think what people have consistently said is, this is a way to help bring parents to the information on the department's website, give them a chance. If they're going to look at 10 schools, they can prioritize how they're going to look at those 10. I'm going to look at these three first, then those three. And I think it's also very valuable. You're going to look at percentage kids that are performing at grade level. You're going to look at a school and how they help students grow academically. You're going to look at a school and see how they're doing with closing achievement gaps. You know, those, I think, are in for high schools, you're going to look at graduation. For school districts, we're using the world's best workforce, which everybody's on board with. So I think these are some, you need to draw some key factors. You can't, a summative rating system can't look at everything. That's what the website's there for. The summative rating system is to look at some key factors that parents can start with, and then as they want to dig in, that's what the website is there for. So frankly, perhaps we disagree, but we've got a lot of great data on the state's website. But people go to greatschools.org because it's got a 1 through 10 rating based strictly on proficiency. This is a much more representative and responsive system for how schools are helping all kids perform.
Is it Makewait? Last question, Madam Chair. Thank you. I think just in summary, I mean, that's what summative means, right? Summary. That's what a summative score would do, is kind of give you a summary of the school. A lot of parents don't have a choice about what school they get to send their kids to. It's just the school that's down the road or the school that's in their community. And so I want to make sure that we are giving them accurate information that is usable. This wouldn't be usable. This wouldn't be usable or helpful, particularly for, you know, rural Minnesota folks where it's just the school that's there. I think we should take another look at this and really do what you're intending to do. I think that's admirable to do what you're intending to do, but what you're doing is not that. Thank you, Madam Chair, for your
Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm struggling with the same issues that we've heard from various testifiers, how a summative assessment really will not, you know, that star rating at the end has so many aspects to it that it may not really reflect the strength of the school and may be conveying, I did statistics, just like we heard this morning, the statistician, and about data points. And what we learned in statistics is garbage in, garbage out. So if we have a number of flawed measurements that we're using to give a final star rating, and we just pack them all together, we really haven't given good information, even if we're using a number of different flawed instruments. And I guess your comment saying that this is just an invitation for parents to come in and look at data, I'm trying to see, where's the follow-up then? Like, you can't look at your star rating until you've reviewed what's in the package so that you have been invited in to understand the data and the complexity of the data. Like, you can't find out a rating until you're equipped to understand it. We're talking about the problem, identifying the problem that nobody's disagreeing with, which is that we have a lot of great data that's not accessible to parents. But by just packaging all the data and giving one answer, isn't necessarily giving parents a great answer, too. What I know for sure is that it will give my real estate agent a really good answer. And I got that part, because it'll be on my, if we ever sell our house, it'll be probably front and center on where our location is and what star our school district has. So where's the invitation to parents to learn more? Other than, because especially when you say, well, here's the star rating, and it's all good, we've got data that we can back it up with, where's the invitation to learn more?
Mr. Bartholomew.
Madam Chair, spacing out.
Representative Pryor.
My apologies. Two things. One on your comment about garbage in, garbage out. I think it's important to remember that as amended, the rating system for schools is strongly aligned to our state ESSA plan, which has been federally peer-reviewed and approved by the U.S. Department of Ed. And as the commissioner mentioned, it's almost 2 years in the making. So I think the elements of our ESSA plan are very sound. For districts, the ratings are based on the world's best workforce, which, again, has been developed maybe 5 years ago and refined over time. That's something that the state is holding our districts accountable for. So if we've got problems with those two things, we've got problems. As the bill mentions, and you said the real estate agent, right now, if I'm looking for a house, pull up a neighborhood, I get greatschools.org or SchoolDigger or another site, and those basically rank schools. I can look on SchoolDigger, and it rates the top 853 elementary schools. Or I can go to great schools and get a 1 to 10 rating there. And those are basically proficiency-based ratings. That's all it is. It's not counting demographics. It's just 1 to 853 based on proficiency. What the ratings in this bill does looks at proficiency as part of it, but also student growth, gap closure, ELL progress, and consistent attendance. Again, all the things that are in our ESSA plan. So our argument is that's much richer data and a much more responsive rating than just a simple proficiency that you'll get on Great Schools or SchoolDigger. So we think parents go to SchoolDigger and Great Schools right now. It's 1 to 10. It's easy. But it's only proficiency. This is a much more responsive indicator for our schools. And the bill mentions that in terms of how do you find it, it says that, and it leaves the discretion to a degree up to the commissioner, but that the rating would be prominently displayed on the report card. So ideally you would, and the work group is still working on what that report card is going to look like, and there's a lot of work for them to do and a lot of promise. But as you pull up schools, you could see the star rating, and then on the menu bar to the left, for example, you could have any series of data points or files that you can open up. So it's you get the rating, and then if you want to dig in, that's going to be on the work group and the department to come up with a revamped report card that, frankly, is a lot easier to use than the current one. But that's the point. All the data will be right there for parents and hopefully much more easier to understand and access. And rather than going to Great Schools or School Digger, they can go to the department's website instead.
Ms. Mariani.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll try to keep this short. And I'll state this right off the bat. My concern is that I think we're simply labeling schools. And labeling schools, I think our history with that has not been good. But let me just ask this, a couple questions. So what parent groups developed this summative rubric that we have in front of us in this bill?
Mr. Bartholomew.
What groups worked on putting this? What parent groups? Well, we had worked with other groups in putting this together and making suggestions. We've worked with through the ASSA committee. I think it was we've worked with we've obviously talked with Ed Allies. They testified in support of it. The parents that have testified before your committee are aware of it. I can't say that they were developed in part of the development of it, but they were aware of it. I don't know if that. A lot of it was developed through the conversations on the ESSA work group and the accountability work group in particular on what kind of indicators should be used. That's helpful.
Madam Chair and Mr. Bartholomew, I guess fair enough, but we also hear from the department that they have stakeholder groups that have not asked for this. I guess we should ask the department if there are parents in that. I'm not aware of a parent group that has constructed this rubric before us. And quite frankly, even the Latino parent groups that we had here, I think we're surprised to find out that there was no EL indicator until yours truly raised that issue. And they affirmed that, in fact, that would be a good thing to do. I listened carefully to their testimony this morning, and they identified three or four other indicators. They weren't talking about this rubric. They were simply stating it in terms of what they need to know. And I think the big difference here, quite frankly, is that I think what's the rubric in front of us doesn't tell us what we need to know. I agree that I think everyone here agrees that we should be telling a story about schools. I don't think this tells the story. At the very least, at the very best, it tells a very incomplete story. As I look at the rubric, it's about proficiency on statewide reading tests, proficiency on statewide math tests, growth rate on statewide reading tests, growth rate on statewide math tests, a low-income student achievement gap score, which goes to the reading test and to the math test. I presume the English literate proficiency rate, which is based on ESSA, is at the very least tied to the reading and math test. And then there is the one kind of different, or not kind of, but different indicator about attendance rate. Of course, the attendance rate and English literate proficiency rate doesn't apply to the district star rating. It only applies to, the elementary schools and to the secondary schools. It seems to me, Ms. Bartholomew, if there's a heavy focus on statewide summative tests, that we already have that. We can access what a school's statewide reading test proficiency is, statewide math test proficiency, growth rate. It's all there. And what I'm hearing is arguments that that's just too much information. But this morning I heard from parents who indicated they wanted at least three other pieces of information. And quite frankly, it's only eight indicators. It's all eight indicators for elementary, seven indicators for secondary, and six indicators for the district itself. That doesn't sound like a complicated thing to report out. If we're interested in reporting the statewide math test, then why not just put out a rubric that has those eight indicators all in a row? And then parents are receiving a story. So I think that I'm not questioning the intent here. I just think that we're telling, you know, the commissioner did say earlier that she's really concerned that we may be telling two different stories that are going to confuse folks. I don't buy the argument that what we're currently reporting out, regardless of what Ms. Cadera said, is terribly complicated. It's eight indicators in the elementary that's been identified in this rubric. You can get that on a quarter page, you know, on a screenshot on the internet. Doesn't seem like a complicated thing to report out. What does seem to me, though, is that a summative test or summative grade doesn't tell me anything about what that school's statewide math performance is. It also doesn't tell me how the attendance rate mitigates what the statewide math attendance performance is in that school. I think we're muddling things up as opposed to making things clearer here. And I do think it's important that when we interact with parents, and I'll be meeting with those Latino parents in a week or so, that we have honest conversations about just how complex this is, but that there are simple ways in which we can do it, and that the proposal before us actually muddles things up. So it concerns me that we really don't have empowered parents coming to this legislature, specifically pointing to this rubric and saying, this is the one that's going to tell me the story that I need to have. On the contrary, we're hearing a different set of voices. At least those are the voices I heard in the last few days, where they wanted much more delineated information. I think we can do it simply. I don't think we need to do this.
Mr. Bartholomew.
Madam Chair, Representative Mariani. I'd like to go back to the fact that the rating system in this bill for districts is straight up aligned with world's best workforce, and that with the addition of the achievement gap closure elements, it's pretty straight up aligned with the school's accountability in ESSA. And we've heard from a number of the school groups in the department that we don't want to send mixed messages, that we'd like to have one accountability system. And I think that's part of the reason why these ratings are so strongly aligned to our ESSA and World's Best Workforce plan, so we can give a consistent message. You know, right now, heaven help the parent who's trying to find World's Best Workforce reports on various district websites to try and see how they're doing. Or, again, you go to MDE's website to try and look at various schools. It's darn hard to find any kind of data on proficiency, growth, gap closure, the access scores, or for the LEP progress. It's so tough. Parents just don't go there, don't know it's there, because there's nobody, so they default to something that's more easy to digest. And so, again, two things. One is, I think we're trying to stay with a consistent message about how our schools are doing, and frankly, we're in this bill follows the department's ESSA plan and World's Best Workforce for consistent messaging. And then, yeah, whatever we can do to help parents get the information they need to look at schools, and I think that's some of just our past practices. Here's our data. You go ahead and make of it what you will. And it just, it overwhelms people. And this is a way to bring people in.
Well, Madam Chair.
Representative Mariani.
And Mr. Bartholomew, So do you have data to show us that people are overwhelmed by using the school finder tool that the parents talked about in testimony here? They gave it good review. You know, these are one-page reports that, in fact, do list out the individual test scores as well as a couple of other indicators. Has there been a study done about whether parents are overwhelmed with that simple one-page representation?
Mr. Bartholomew.
Chair Representative Mariani, we do not do the school finder. I think you should talk to the people who produce that. One comment I've heard is that parents have one bit of feedback is parents would like that even. There have been A to F is something they would like because they get A to F. Their students come home with grades all the time, and they, you know. So I think making it as accessible as possible is the challenge and is the key. But in terms of doing studies and further comments about the school finder per se, that would be more appropriate for the people who produce that.
Sure, and I'll stop after this. Mr. Bartholomew, you're the one who told us that current data sets out there are overwhelming. I'm just asking whether you thought then that the current data set in the school finder is overwhelming because we heard a different thing from parents. But let me ask this. Do you sit on the NDE stakeholder group? Have you participated in that group? And if you have, what is it about that group's work that you find so objectionable that we need to have this rubric instead of what they're producing?
Mr. Bartholomew.
Madam Chair, Representative Mariani, just first on the comment about the department's data being overwhelming, I can't tell you how many people I've been on the phone trying to work them through the department's report.
Mr. Bartholomew, I didn't ask you about the department's data set. I asked you about this thing called the school finder. You made a blanket statement that, and you're leading us to believe, that it's just impossible to put together a simple piece that can tell enough information for parents. And I'm telling you, here in public testimony, parents, you know, spoke very highly about this school finder. So that's why I asked you about that. But let me, because I don't want to use up more of the committee's time, do you participate in the NDE stakeholder group?
Mr. Bartholomew.
Madam Chair, Representative Mariani, I in terms of the data dashboard specifically.
And so then, Madam Chair, Mr. Bartholomew, what is it about the NDE stakeholder group? I mean, quite honestly, what is it about that they're doing and the direction that they're going that would lead you to believe that it's important to supplant what they're doing and replace this rubric in its stead, which, by the way, has no parent, official parent endorsement on it. What is it? What's driving this?
Mr.
Relative to the MDE statement?
Madam Chair, Representative Mariani, there's nothing objectionable with the work group. I've been at one meeting. They still have more to go. And for you to hear the message that members of the work group don't support summative ratings, that may be a majority opinion, not a 100% opinion. There are divided voices on that work group. So I think that's important to know.
Madam Chair, Mr. Bartholomew, that will also happen in this committee. There will not be a unified voice on this issue as well, and the majority may well decide to adopt this rubric. Certainly it will be a majority vote. So that's not unusual. I think where I would empathize, and I asked this question to Mr. Uni, is, you know, when do they expect to roll something out? Because clearly there's agreement, there is a need for us to consistently work at clarifying information about schools. So I'm a little, concerned about, the pace at which the department may be moving here. But we haven't heard testimony about that. We haven't heard how that stakeholder group is going. I think, frankly, we ought to wait to see what they do. At the very least, we ought to hear from them more in depth before we vote on this. what direction the stakeholder group is going and when they would expect to come forward with something that hopefully would be better than what we have in front of us here today. So, Madam Chair, that's all I have. I don't want to eat up more of your time.
Representative Bly, is your question for Mr. Bartholomew?
Yes.
Please.
Thank you. So I'm a little confused because you've talked about how the rating system would be an invitation to look deeper into other information, and yet you're also talking about how parents really want a simple grade, like they get a grade on the report card from their kids. And, for me, the more that you reduce the try to cover more with the measure that you're doing and make the measure more concise and smaller to make it clearer, you lose all of the information that's really important to know. And I guess, how does this work? So the rating system would be out there, and would there be, you really need to look more closely at the data to find out what this really means for your school? Or do you think parents are just going to say, oh, that star rating tells me that's the best school, so I'll send my kids there? How does that work? I'm confused by what you presented.
Mr. Bartholomew.
Madam Chair, Representative Bly, it is our intent to try and make the rich information that's available on the department's website more accessible, more used by families and the public. Right now, and it's part of a response to Representative Mariani's question, right now the department's report card and website is fairly inaccessible just because of how it's laid out, and there's little direction there. You need a lot of time to figure it out. What we're hoping, and we would agree with you, that you can't have a rating system that includes 50 different items and then average them all down into one. That obscures the individual points, and that's why I think this bill is been good in trying to keep it to three or four buckets. And again, it's grade level performance, growth, achievement gap closure, ELL progress, and attendance. The bill keeps it to a limited number of things, so it still is informative. The idea is hopefully we can do a good job of letting parents and families know that the department's website is a good place to go. It's easy to use. You can have some star summative ratings to begin to organize the schools you want to look at, so you're not faced with data points on 20 different schools, but you can say, I want to take this group of three or five, look at those, and then move on to the next group. I don't think there's a whole lot more than that, and we would certainly encourage parents, don't just look at the star. You don't look at a rating and make a decision as important as what school you're going to enroll your child in based on a star rating. That's the beginning. And then once you've accessed that data, you've got what the state has, and then ideally you would go to that individual school and do a site visit if you could. But it's a big decision where you're going to send your child.
Representative Blatt.
Thank you, Chair. I understand that. It's not well formed enough, I guess, for me to see it working in the way that you describe. And I guess what I fear is that down the road, perhaps this rating system will be used for other purposes. If parents look at this rating system and start leaving schools that may be good schools, but the measurements that you're using don't necessarily show the things that that school might be good at or that they might be performing well at. And, will it change the success of schools themselves because parents are not choosing this school because it has this kind of star rating? And I guess I don't know if this is really going to be helpful I hear what it sounds like you're telling me is that if they don't pay that much attention to it, it'll be helpful. If they paid a lot of attention to it, then it's a problem.
Mr. Bartholomew.
Madam Chair, Representative Bly, I think we're getting this rating system confused with what we used to have. which was basically a proficiency model. I think the elements in the model in the bill, again, that have growth and gap closure are really going to identify schools, diverse schools, that are helping all students succeed. Those schools that help all kids succeed are going to really be recognized under this system. And I'm not sure if my daughters are being successful and are happy at the school they're at, that's a school I'm not going to be dissuaded by. The school in the next district has a higher star rate. You know, what's most important is happening with my daughters in their classroom. So, the star rating is for informational purposes at the beginning, and we want to draw parents in. But if they're enrolled in the school and everything's going well, I think they'll stay.
Thank you, Mr. Bartholomew. Fred Nolan. Welcome to our committee, Mr. Nolan. Please say your name for the record and begin.
I'm Fred Nolan, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Rural Education Association, representing 224 rural school districts and 30 cooperatives through Greater Minnesota. I basically agree with the comments made by the other education organizations, AMSD, MSBA, the principals, Josh Nelson from Minneapolis, so I'm not going to go over that. There's two pieces of information I want to bring to you. One, to follow up on this last conversation. I think I'm a member of the stakeholder group. I attended the dashboard meeting on Monday. I think we have in our mind the MMR, which we can discuss, and the current report card. And you're given a choice of a rating system to replace the MMR, but you haven't seen the new dashboard look from the department. Now, it's a work in progress, but rather than looking at charts, they're thinking of having just buttons. Proficiency, growth, reading math, attendance, ELL. You could tell at a glance kind of how a school was doing, okay? Now, they weren't really prepared to come at this level because it's a progress that's going to be done after they had the ESSA plan. But I'd highly recommend you look at it before you make a decision. That's point number one. Point number two, on the testing window, I actually kind of like your language, latest time period available, and let the commissioner determine. But I want you to make aware that Minneapolis will be dismissing the last day on June 8th. And I have a number of member districts that have the last day May 22nd. Most rural districts do not take spring break. They barely take a week at Christmas. Representative Blias is smiling, okay? We live that life. They want to be out. If they can be out before Memorial Day, they love it. If not, right after Memorial Day. So the latest window, you really almost need 2 weeks before the first school kind of gets out. So you're probably back to May 8th is kind of your last testing date. Just want to give that as a piece of information to realize that there's a wide variety of when districts end. And with that, late in the evening, I'll end. But I'll be available for questions.
Thank you, Dr. Nolan. I will end with Mr. Heller. Welcome to our committee, Mr. Heller. Please say your name for the record, and please address the delete all to 3315, please.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Erickson, and members of the Education Innovation Policy Committee. My name is Rick Heller. I officially represent the twice exceptional House File 1072. Minnesota Statute 120B-15. Come testify on the delete bill. I think I'll save the accessibility for last. And if I can start. Going to, based on the summary, going to page 3. Item 8, or in the amended file 1028 through 1030. I highlight must publish the school performance report for the district, each school site on the district website, or link to reports at the Ministry of Department of Education website. For everybody's information, who has a pen and wants to track or scribe this down as, first of all, the summaries that go back to the State Department are required to be fully accessible. However, I have yet to find one full World's Best Workforce report that's fully accessible, because districts don't have to apply 508. However, there are three school districts that do, because the quasi, your school district of state agencies, the Burbage Center, the Blind Academy, and the Deaf. My suggestion for those who want to do an amendment, to put together a task force, because next year all school districts apply 508. Let your people analyze it, write amendment. Next one, item 10 on the same page. Apparently they're going to identify dyslexia from second grade on. I believe that's on 11.33 through 12.2. Now we go to number 18, if I may. Under item E in the top of the page, page 5, here we are identifying low-income students, free and reduced lunch prices. We're almost there on Minnesota Statute 120B15. We have yet to identify the twice exceptional. However, House File 2, which did not pass, the legislature did not know what twice exceptional was, and they changed it to disabled and gifted. Currently, because there is no definition, according to Mr. Melcher at the Minnesota Department of Education, correct me if I'm wrong, the State Department is here, there's no way of tracking those programs for the twice exceptional. So if you created a definition, perhaps that would be a good start of knowing who the twice exceptional are. And then on page 9 of the same docket for the summary, under Special Education Work Group, Subdivision 1 of Duties, I've testified before, I'll testify again, that because the technology assessment came to the legislature, they mentioned 6 times three groups of words: selection, acquisition, and use. They also mentioned UDL. That was in House File 2, wasn't it, Carlos? Don't have to answer. I got
good memory.
How many minutes? Anyways, that's on page 56 through 29 through 57, 21, I believe. And by the way, if you go to page 14 of that document, you will find UDL. You also find AIM, Access Educational Materials, Excellence Instructional Materials. What is that all about? And last but least, back to the legislature, 1541, and here's my suggestion. Since the governor's bill is not marked as a governor's bill, and that document went through the process to be made accessible, there's 2 Heller handouts tonight. The one you can't read, however, I believe the members got one that was clear. Jason specifically said unless the bill gets a number, this is posted on a data practice commission, it does not become fully accessible. Here we got a document that's 3 times the size of the governor's bill that's not fully accessible for the blind and the disabled. I think when you violate ADA, you violate everybody. The legislature went through great means through minute grant dollars, which is found on the data practice commission, to make these documents more accessible regarding structural and underlying language. That's the suggestions I have. However, I do have questions specifically to the State Department, only yielded to the chair, and it has to do with triangulation. And we talk about, I'll give you one example, maybe two if you like, if the time allows, but you hold the minutes. But for instance, the idea was
a system that the Minnesota Department of Education created for engagement for the public. Two things. That survey and that input for that does not comply to 508. Number two, the Every Student Success Act is not fully accessible, including the summary. So if that matters, obviously I'm not successful with complaints with Minute, and at this time I've given up regarding their responsibility on this. And Minute is formerly Office of Enterprise Technology and Force 508. So one thing, if you all know about the triangle, with the Common Core, you got qualitative, quantitative, and on task. Minnesota, again, adopted Lexile. They have broken Lexile now in three categories for each grade. Not only Lexile altogether, but the frequency of the vocabulary and the length of the sentence. And that affects how kids select. This is district creating the documents. Acquisition, how you take it in. And use, how you express it. UDL, what, how, and why. That's why I suggested, with the other handout I have not mentioned, the reason why Social Security.gov and accessibility plugin and USCourts.gov is using a plugin called Browse Aloud. They don't even mention the blind. They mention learning disabilities, dyslexia, and English as a second language. What is it all about? We want everybody proficient in English orally. That's what it's about. So the fact is, if we're looking at students, they're going to have a label. Don't we want to look at their potential, their ability? Because special ed does not identify the gifts. It only identifies the strengths. If we're going to make the world's best workforce work, regarding career and college readiness, which is one of the key elements in closing the achievement gap, and also graduating on time with your peers. Just three of those would apply to the process. So remember, if districts are using formative and summative, MCAs, formative, instructional, they're all using Lexile. It's specifically for the kid. I would appreciate a phone call to the State Department. I do have a data request I've been waiting for about 2 years ago. You guys wanted a law about setting the text complexity of special education forms. Would be expedient for you guys to know what level that is, what metric that might be, and apply to the students' IEPs. Those are my suggestions. Obviously, there's much more. I've gone past my time, and I appreciate this opportunity to speak.
Thank you, Mr. Heller. Members, I have a question about the concern that has come from testifiers tonight about my changing may to must in those areas for the health curriculum. What is your desire? Do I keep a must? Do we go back to may, or do we do something else? Representative Erin Maquette.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you just point me to a page 15?
This is page 7. Whoops, no. Yes. Page 7, starting with line 7.15. And last year when we passed Aaron's law, Representative Bennett's provision, we used a permissive may. And then this year we had Representative Jessup and Representative Pryor's sex trafficking, sexual exploitation. So when we constructed this, we, of course, added that to this paragraph. And then we had Representative Kunesh-Pradeen, yes, thank you, add Jake's Law. So we have three different areas that are of great concern to me added to the health curriculum, which you heard the testifiers say is not standard. It is individual per district. So I need to know how to proceed. Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As an educator, I understand sometimes the complexity and the difficulty when the legislation or districts mandate a new program or a new curriculum. You know, our initial reaction is like, oh no, one more thing, one more piece that we have to fit into our already very, very full plate. Personally, I think I came into the legislation, into the legislature, with the mindset that I did not want to incur more of those kind of burdens or extra load onto the teachers or the curriculum people or our district. I would prefer that it was a May. It would be my choice that it would be a May. I would strongly encourage it, and I would hope that they would take all three of these really important current issues and situations and find a way to incorporate them into their health programs. I know in my school district, at the middle school, in our health curriculum, it's a very, very outdated curriculum that we have there. I would really like to remove it, but it's the only one that we have. And sometimes as the curriculum person, I'm always looking for fresh material. And teachers are always looking for current and updated information as well. With the sex trafficking issue and Aaron's Law, those are really important as well. But what I really appreciated with Jake's bill is that we are trying to work really hard to have the materials and the curriculum ready to go. It would really be no expense to the school district other than time, and time is very precious in a school day. And so the curriculum that Jake's bill would put together would be, they've worked so hard on it already. They've worked in conjunction with other school districts, always checking with MDE standards and that sort of thing. And as an example, this year I know in my school district they were doing a sex ed curriculum part. The teachers were not comfortable doing it themselves. They didn't feel that they were ready for it, and they were able to bring in a community expert on it, an outside group that actually did the instruction along with the teacher. And so that is something that I would hope we could do along the way. But if it were me and if it were up to me, I would ask you to choose me.
Thank you, Representative Kunesh-Kadeem. How about members if we did is encouraged? I know that's a fallback, but maybe if a district hears is encouraged instead of may, does that bring a little bit more emphasis? Representative Kunesh-Kadeem, you're in the field.
Yes, I think it would be. I think it absolutely would be. When we hear may, okay, we can get it in there. But when you hear is encouraged, I guess I feel like, ooh, okay, they want us to really do this. They're not going to, say, use mamsy-pamsy language. But I think the is encouraged is also a good option.
Thank you. And then would you check page 15? Because that's where Jake's Law appears. So in line 15.16, do you want to keep that as must since you're hoping to gain something in finance, or would you be okay if that must on line 16 were also changed to are encouraged to?
I would change that to is encouraged to. Part of the grant money or the monies that we're hoping to get from the education finance, it's not going to cover the entire state, and we're not going to be able to provide this to the entire state. And unless we had those funds there where there was training for teams and they could go out to every single school and incorporate this, then I would say perhaps must. But if we can't put the money where our mouth is, then I would say more of that permissive language, encouraging language would be most appropriate.
Thank you. I'm going to call on Representative Bennett, since you authored Aaron's Law, and ask about effective date. We've had the effective date for Aaron's Law and the sex trafficking put at the 1920 school year, and I guess I didn't ask the testifiers if that was an issue, but if it's encouraged, perhaps they could start thinking about it this coming school year. But what is your preference, Representative Bennett?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I would say my preference would probably be to be consistent with the Jakes Law legislation. I think it falls in a similar category.
How about effective date?
For effective date.
And if there's a testifier who wants to come forward?
Yeah, I guess I'd. Okay.
They're going to make me do this.
Madam Chair, could I make a
yes, please.
Comment? Thank you, Madam Chair, on the must versus encourage. I like encouraged better than may. But in the situation of certain items, and
yes,
I look,
we won't change those musts.
Okay, which?
So on line 7.17.
Okay.
Because if there's going to be instruction, this is what they must. So it would only be the opening verb.
Okay.
So in line 15, a school district is encouraged to include child sex abuse and sexual exploitation. Then in line 29, a school district is encouraged to include instruction in a health curriculum for students in grades 5, 6, 8, 10, and 12. And we've already made a qualifier there in our amendment, which you'll see on Thursday. And then on page 15, section 13, Representative Kunesh-Badin has also agreed that line 16 would be school districts and charter schools are encouraged to include. But the other musts would stay, because if they do this, then we've set down what they must do for that.
Madam Chair?
Representative Bennett first.
Yeah, thank you. So I just want to clarify, they're encouraged to do this, and if they do it, they must
yes.
do. Okay, I guess I'd like to add a thought. I as much as I don't want mandates, I do believe that there are certain things that are critical enough to a child's life and their future life, sex abuse, sex trafficking, and the opioids and the whole, that it is so debilitating to a child's life that I just feel like these have to be raised to a higher standard than many things. Now, I think we need to work heartily as a committee to get rid of a lot of mandates that we have, especially unfunded ones. I'd like to see these funded. I know for Aaron's Law, there is some federal funding available
yes.
for curriculum.
Yes.
And that's not like a huge time. It's like a once-a-year thing for students. But I do believe in these three situations especially, and there's obviously a few more. This is hugely debilitating to a child, and when they start on the drugs, as we found out with Jake, that's life-ending. And we heard from the sex abuse people both last year and this year, and it is life-debilitating where they're with mental health issues and things their entire life. So as much as I don't like to see the word must, I do think districts should have to teach this. And I know we're not about that, but I see it as a raised level of importance here. So that's just my thought on it.
Mr. Arnson, you want to respond to our dilemma?
Well, you asked about the effective dates. And I would say if you're going to make these discretionary, we package these up. The department packages up all the stuff that you passed. And then we go in and train people for next year. And I think there'd be some risk that some of this might get lost if you delayed it a year. So I think it'd make a lot of sense if it's discretionary that you make it effective for the 18-19 school year, Madam Chair.
So, Mr. Ironson, are you saying you support is encouraged or are encouraged, whichever we need to
Absolutely,
use?
Madam Chair. We do, when we do all of the legal workshops and the department does their updates, we take all of those directives very seriously and really do say, put these things in your practices and policies and do them. That's the direction that you want to have. And with a couple of pieces that you don't want to have something that went south and then someone said there was this directive, did you do it? And we want to say that you did. So we think that's a good way to make them effective in the upcoming year, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Arnson. I'm not going to call on other members because I think we resolved this. But are there other questions of the author of the bill? Her language. We've done a lot of amending, which you don't all know about yet, but we've had Christina very busy already taking the concerns we heard this morning and converting them. Representative Erdahl, did I offend you?
Yes.
Oh, come back and ask your question. Didn't mean to do that. I thought we had passed this. No, of course, I want you to ask a question. Anyway, getting back to the point, we have taken the suggestions from this morning, and converted them into language that we think is making the bill even better based on everything that came to us. Representative Verdahl. I'm sorry about the civics.
Thank you. First of all, usually we have the conversation and then we reach the conclusions. I really didn't think we'd completed the conversation.
About these three provisions, you mean?
How about must?
Yeah. Proceed.
You know, the question was, and I wanted to answer it, the importance of must or may or whatever. If must, if something is important to you, you say must. If it's not important, you don't. If you use may, it doesn't mean you have to do it. If you use encouraged, it doesn't mean you have to do it. Whether it's any of these things we've been talking about or civics or anything else, mentoring, anything else. And that's what's been proven to be true in the state of Minnesota. It's why we don't have a consistent mentorship program. It's why we don't teach civics properly in the schools. And I could go on and on and on. If you use must, it's done. If you use it encourage or may, it might or it might not. Depends on how important that particular teacher or school district thinks it is. That's it.
Well, thank you, Representative Verdahl. That's why I converted the may to must. But, you know, when we hear testimony from the people in the field, you know, I get a little concerned about what are we doing, as you heard Representative Kunesh-Podein refer to. And she's in the field. You know, you and I are retired, so we're not right there and getting the, you know, input from our colleagues. But so I don't know. Have we reached a consensus or not, Representative Mariani?
Madam Chair, I would only add that, and Representative Bennett mentioned this as well, that and to Representative Verdahl's point, that part of how we demonstrated we really needed is we also paid for it. And I know that's not the only issue here. There are some other issues. I think Mr. Aronson, who is an attorney, but spared us, you know, a lot of attorney legalese, nonetheless would say that there are, you know, some other potentially liability issues here. You know, if we set up a strong expectation, and we don't have enough time, to roll out the policy and the practice, and of course, if we don't resource it, then you kind of open yourself up for legal action. So I get that as well, but I do think that part of what we struggle with, and it's part of what any policy committee is always going to struggle with, is that we're not the arbiters, if you will, of the resource issue. And so I think whatever we can do to double down. To make sure that we're providing state resources for school districts to be able to carry out what may be some pretty heavy lifts at times is also an important way for us to demonstrate that we really mean it.
Well, my comment would be last year we were okay with May in child abuse, and that's, I think, how we got it enacted into law. Now we've added two other topics. Representative
Quaid. Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to echo what Representative Bennett said. After we passed Aaron's Law, I had a mom in the district email me and say that she wished it would have been a must, that this language is so important for students to learn. And I would add, I know we're not on, well, we're on other committees, but this isn't other committees. We might be saving the state dollars in other places by making sure our students are learning this really important stuff. So I would just leave it at that this might be helpful. And I wouldn't want students from different parts of the state to have this knowledge and not have this knowledge. I think it's important that all our students have it, regardless of their district.
Well, members, if we do must, then the effective dates have to be into the future. So I think, Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Interesting discussion and very important. I'm carrying some trafficking bills and looking at working with the people who have been dealing with this in public safety, I think they would also say must. So can we build in some timelines? Maybe we say are encouraged to for this first year and develop. How, I don't know how you want to say that, but maybe the first year has to be, must develop the curriculum capacity and then have a deadline as soon as you think that it's reasonable and that we can fund. And I think the people who have, are keeping our streets safe would say it can't wait.
Is there anyone in the audience who would like to add anything? Yes, here comes School Boards Association. We better hear from them. Welcome back, Ms. Kelleher.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Grace Kelleher, and I represent the Minnesota School Boards Association. And I deeply appreciate the discussion tonight. I do not want to discount how important these items are to bring forward. But the idea that we have to enact them here, and unless you force us to do it, we won't teach it, really is disrespectful to the local school board officials who serve and who spend time in their community and listen to their teachers and, you know, bring it every day, all day, for the kids in their district. And it's unfortunate that, you know, I can think of 20 other things we should put in here that are important. I mean, but school districts across Minnesota differ in their approach to issues. And I really ask you to consider that not every school district comes at the issue the same way because our communities are so different. And there needs to be an appreciation of the diversity and then the quality and standards you expect school board members to do. And I want to reiterate what Mr. Aronson said. I know he goes around the state, MDE does. But we also highlight topics at our leadership conference.
Yes.
And we bring people in and we start there and let them know what's available and go forward. And I really plead with you. I suggest that instead of mandating it, give us some time to do our job, to get the word out that these are your priorities. It's a little difficult because there are so many, many good causes out there. And so, you know, getting back to our mission, we want to, the required academic standards are what you are giving us as policy to accomplish with our children. And they're numbered out in front of us to accomplish. And you're just continuing to add to the list. And if I can make one plea for you to consider, you know, just as much as we want to decide we need to do this and we need to do this, the one person who always sort of gets forgotten is kids. They'd love to have another elective. They'd love to have a choice to study something they're interested in or they're concerned about. So if you could give us a little bit more flexibility, I think your communities, your boards, your parents, teachers, and kids can make the right decisions. So thank you, Madam Chairman. I appreciate the opportunity to get back up and share.
Thank you, Ms. Kelleher. Representative Erdahl, do you have a question for Ms. Kelleher?
I do. And, you know, first of all, thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Kelleher, I mean no disrespect for any school board in the state of Minnesota. What I'm saying is if something is really important to you, you have to say must. There are a lot of other things that you can say encourage, that you can say may. But I simply have one question for you. It says in statute that schools are encouraged to have mentorship programs. Can you guarantee for me that every school district in the state of Minnesota has a mentorship program?
Ms. Kelleher.
Madam Chairman, Representative Erdahl, you bring up a good point. You and I have had the ability to talk about this. I have not done a poll of school districts, but I was a school board member back in the 90s, early 90s. And our Albert Lea School District always had a mentoring. We were first in the state to do that. There is a strong best practices success rate on that. And it's something we've advocated for as an organization all the time. It makes sense. And you and I have talked about it. Man, you know, I can't give you, I mean, if you'd like me to pull my members, I'd be happy to do that and get back with a response. But I, at this point, cannot give you that number.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mrs. Kelleher, I appreciate that. I know of school districts that don't have mentorship programs.
And Representative Erdahl, some of them, they're not mentorship programs, but they're built into the teacher evaluation plans. But, you know, not having read every evaluation plan, I'm not sure to what extent that occurs. So you make a good point. So, members, we've been here a long time, and we need to visit with Christina, at least I do, because she has much work ahead of her tonight. Miss Larson, you wanted to speak? This will have to be the last testifier. And I know she comes to us with a passion now because I understand the issue. Please say your name for the record, Miss Larson, and begin.
Certainly. My name is Peg Larson. I'm with the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault. And I would say thank you very much to Representative Erdahl and Bennett and Mariani and May Quaid for saying that this is a very important issue. Minnesota ranks fourth for sex trafficking in the United States. And we do feel very strongly that it should be a must, because otherwise we have no assurance that things will be done. And we would ask you to please consider that.
Thank you, Ms. Larson.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you,
Madam Chair.
So, members, I think with that, this meeting is adjourned.